I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve the Rock County check sheet for April 16th, 2019. Accounts payable check, and all of these checks are cycle date April 8th through April 12th. So for accounts payables, $2,027,054.48. Payroll checks, $521,210.88. Payroll checks manuals, $14,291.57, and IRS and state income tax wires in the amount of $218,018.43, for total disbursements approved of $2,780,575.36.
Second. Discussion? Items of note?
Yes, I do have some. I have a payment to Arthur J. Gallagher. This is for inmate catastrophic health insurance, and it's for the premium for that, for the sheriff's adult detention budget, $13,968. Payment to Correctional Health Care Management. This is from the detention budget, and this is for inmate medical services for the month of May 2019, so services that are provided year-round, but this is for the May payment. Payment to Central Electric Facilities Management. This is for repair of electrical conduit at the adult detention. Evidently, when they were cutting the concrete slab out there, the electrical conduit was damaged. So $6,509.50. That's when they were, I believe, installing the cutting the concrete so they could install a shower. Payment to the town of Hayden. This is YVRA budget, and this is for law enforcement services at the airport for the month of March 2019, $12,448.84. We had some budget allocation payments, distributions to Northwest Colorado Health, Yampa Valley Housing Authority, and the road levies to the municipalities. Then also we had payments of employee benefit contributions, Federal Credit Union, and ICMARC, so they were payroll-type activities within that AP cycle, or this AP cycle. Have a payment to Transwest Trucks, Inc. This is from the heavy equipment pool and the purchase of two 2018 Western Star plow trucks, and those are 4x4 trucks. Total of the two, $455,149. Payment to the Department of Interior, USGS, and this is from the Environmental Health Budget and the Upper Yampa River Water Quality Monitoring Program, payment of $11,177. Payment to Bear Communications, Inc. This is from the Comm Center. This is for parts for the comm band, just $869, and the rest of it for installation of antenna mast and a mounting structure on the CLEF project, so moving from one end of the building to the other. The antenna cost and the mask cost was $8,734.96. And then we, if you remember, we purchased a Connex storage container for the sheriff's office, which is just a temporary thing, but the storage of evidence for the sheriff's office. And then once we're done with that project, we'll move that container out to the District 3 shop next to the Weed building. So the purchase was $3,900. Just to rent the Connex for that period of time was going to be $2,500. So now we'll have a container for anything we need in the future.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Throws me off when Doug's not here. Yesterday, we had our work session, and we had updates from the county manager, legal, Public Works, the Yampa Valley Regional Airport, the CSU Extension, and the weed program.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve consent agenda items A, B, and C.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Yes, I can.
You guys all need name tags. It's really nice. When it really helps a lot.
I know. I was like, that's new. That's fancy.
Yeah.
That's because I have a shirt on.
You can thank Tim for it being so big.
Yeah, my assistant did the big and little.
Thank you all for coming. We're considering your request to adopt a resolution proclaiming this as Broward County Public Safety Telecommunicators Week. Sorry. Not telecommunications, telecommunicators.
So I have a little background information.
Yes, please.
EPCO International sets aside the second full week of April to honor the many telecommunicator professionals who aid in providing 911 emergency assistance to citizens everywhere. Every week, hundreds of Broward County residents depend on the skill, expertise, and commitment of our dispatchers who help save lives by responding to emergency calls, dispatching emergency professionals and equipment, and providing moral support to citizens in distress. Rapid response, poised under pressure, aid with compassion in times of distress, and critical decision-making within seconds are a few of the vital attributes of our team. Telecommunicators provide the vital link by communicating accurate information from the citizen to law, fire, and emergency services, monitoring their activities by radio to ensure their safety. By recognizing these individuals, we hope to awaken public awareness and promote such needed education regarding important public safety issues and legislation. And just another tidbit, this has sort of been an industry standard, a nationwide standard for the United States. A dispatcher in Contra Costa County, California, started this in 1981. So this has been sort of a standard for the second week of April to be recognized as. And you guys know in the last 40 years, there's been a lot of changes and progressions in 911 in general and telecommunications, public safety telecommunications around the country. So we think it's important. And before we get to the resolution, I'd just like to say that I appreciate the support that I've received since I've come on board from County Manager's Office and from the Commissioners. We have a wonderful staff. We just have a small sampling of our staff here today, but
it's good. We need somebody.
Yeah, somebody was again.
I would like to say publicly that we would not have been successful, not have been able to accomplish the goals that we set when I came on board a couple of years ago without the dedication of the staff that we have. So I definitely appreciate their hard work. And
thank you very much. I think we can all not fully appreciate, honestly, how hard your jobs are. And so thank you very much for the work that you do. And I hope that the commitment to this work is demonstrated by Broward County. I was just asked to be reminded about how much money we spend on not as negative. I think, you know, the money we spend indicates the importance, and so we'd like to appreciate the work that you all do.
Well, having the support is huge, because I can tell you that I am involved in some of our national organizations and our state APCO and NENA organization, working with our peers, and we are ahead of a lot of other people in Northwest Colorado and the state with our technology, recognizing that where we need to go with that, as far as our CAD systems and telephone call processing and other technology that we have. So I appreciate that support. You know, without you guys being there to support that and help us with the budgeting and that sort of thing, we wouldn't be able to have the toys that we have and be a leader in 911 telecommunications. So it's definitely appreciated.
And thank you for your leadership on that as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you guys are invisible until somebody needs you, you know. And I think the idea that there's always somebody there when 911 and people that have never had to call 911. And thankfully, I've never had to call 911 in my life. But, I mean, I'm aware of the work that you guys do because of the job that I have now. Honestly, before I became a county commissioner, it was like, just call 911 if you have a problem.
Out of sight,
without ever thinking about what really went into that. Well, I've got a couple of people sitting down there answering telephones, how big of a deal can it be? And now I've come to appreciate about how big of a deal it can be. And I hope, I'm sure that you guys are as excited as I am about the new digs.
Yes.
Have you guys had
the
opportunity to take a look at it?
Yes.
That's great. Yes.
Several times.
Yeah.
It's going to be nice. It's going to be a nice change.
Yeah, I think that there will be a much better work environment than what you have now. Of course, we set the bar pretty low. So having said all that, do I have a resolution number?
I believe it's 12.
I'm sorry, it's not on here.
I think it's in our agenda.
I
think it's in our agenda. It is 12.
Yeah, don't you take that upon yourself. We'll decide what number it is.
It is 12. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to approve resolution number 2019-12. A resolution proclaiming the week of April 14th, 2019 as Rock County Public Safety Telecommuters Week in honor of the men and women whose diligence and professionalism keep our county and citizens safe.
Second. Any other discussion?
No.
Thank you. Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I'll take that. Are you going to take a picture, Dan?
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, no.
You had to expect
this. Yeah, there's no getting around.
Yeah.
What's your name?
My name is Matthew.
I'm sorry, I was going to introduce myself as well.
How long have you guys?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Well, my name's Oman, so I didn't
know Matthew. That's why we're almost 3 years.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
If you guys want to sit, we can stand behind you.
No, that's awkward.
Okay.
That's awkward.
That's awkward.
Just push these chairs.
Right?
It's all awkward. We'll stand in front of Sarah.
Oh, yes.
You want to hop in there?
I'll be in
front of you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to
hop in there.
Hold on,
Dan.
Telecommunicators.
We love telecommunications.
Thank you. Thank
you all so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
When's lunch? Aren't you serving us?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
So the Steamboat Springs Police Department is
what
doing
we
a
get
cookout
for
us, and you guys are welcome to come.
I've gone a couple times. It's good.
It's Friday from 1 to 3 is the plan.
So
hamburgers,
Friday?
Hot dogs, grilled, yes.
We're both out of town.
Sorry about that.
You guys are welcome there, to come
over
and grill.
Thank you.
If you can schedule it around us next time.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's that?
If anyone wants to come over on Thursday morning, I'm going to bring the...
Okay. I was hoping we were going to do something. Thanks for taking care of that. We'll take credit. 11:05. Come on up.
All right.
Just checking the time. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Sergeant, right?
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's all good. You can call me whatever you want.
Just keep the checks coming.
Yeah.
With the contract.
Yeah. All right.
So we are taking a look at the Mine Springs Health contract with the Rock County Detention Center.
Correct. And this is just the updated contract. Eric has already reviewed it and made the necessary changes to it, or recommendations that he wants to it. And they made the revisions. I have his email here with the proposed revisions on it, and then the updated contract. So,
and he indicated to us yesterday that he wanted a wet signature on it. Do we have that?
I don't, but I can. I mean, because they do this stamp signature on all their contracts, even their previous contracts that I was looking at. So I have to get in touch with Gina Toothaker to see if she can get a wet signature on it. Do you want me to get that before?
I don't really know. Do we know what Eric's concern was? or question?
I know.
He wants a real signature.
He recommended it. He said,
It's up to you. Normally, you don't sign, commissioners don't sign the contract until the other party has signed the contract.
Well, okay. We can go ahead and approve the contract. You can get the signature and drop it back off for her signature.
Well, and I think considering that there were revisions, I would like to also see legal stamp on the version that we actually signed.
That's needed.
Exactly. Thing. So I think we can approve the...
Approve the contract, noting that it still needs a this version needs to be stamped by the county attorney and signed by someone from Mind Springs. Well, not someone, an authorized someone.
Not just anyone.
I'll just go over there and be like, hey, can you sign this for me?
So can you briefly update us on where the change is technical in nature?
I've seen the changes. Do you want to show them?
Well, Lieutenant Boyle would just give a quick rundown of what those changes were.
Yeah.
Sure, there were some small revisions just to the verbiage of the contract. Instead of referring to them as prisoners, as inmates, he switched that around.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other verbiage in there was what he changed, but I think the big thing was he wanted to add in the under insurance under the Section E, that such insurance shall provide that it may not be canceled without 30 days prior written notice to the county. He said that he didn't know if they would actually go for that or not. And this is the revised copy that they gave me, and I did give it to Eric, and I made the note to Eric when I emailed him. I said, hey, everything looks like it's been changed except that section. They didn't add it here, so, and he said that's fine.
And then the version that I saw, they also did add some language about them not getting paid when they don't deliver services.
Correct, yeah, that's what I was getting, because I remember our last conversation.
Yeah, I
asked Kelly if I could get that verbiage from her, so... Yeah, so it does say.
Okay, well then, right.
I had one other question, and maybe this was fixed, but there was when I looked through the version that was in our packet, which I know was not the most current version. It referred to the county executive director.
What, an older contract?
It was in Section H under confidentiality. And I just assume that we would like that to reflect. I assume that's meant to be the county manager.
Let me see. Well, you might assume that.
Yeah. In Section H.
I'm not sure. This was 2018.
Do you have just the version that you're asking us to approve today?
Because I think
you can just double
check
in that one and see if that. So it's in the section on confidentiality, Section H. One more page. Here. Yeah, it does. It says. It's sort of a weird, what page is it? Page 28 in our packet. Page 3 of the contract. So it's talking about confidentiality and it's talking about business information. I mean, it's a pretty standard section of a contract in general, but it says, unless specifically authorized in writing in advance by the county executive director.
Which should say county manager.
I would imagine.
So why don't we get that change made prior to having Eric stamp it and bring that to Eric's attention?
Okay, just get a change from executive director to executive
to manager. County manager.
Right.
It's sort of a weird clause to have in there anyway, but if they put that in all their contracts, it should at least refer to the correct person.
So, Madam Chair, noting the changes that include changing the phraseology from county executive director to county manager, noting that we will require a wet personal signature from an authorized individual at Mind Springs, and noting that this will have to be stamped by our county attorney prior to being signed by the chair, I would move to approve and authorize the chair to sign the MindSpring's mental health contract for mental health services at the Rout County Detention Center after those requirements have been met.
Second. Any other discussion on that?
No, ma'am.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Thank you for following up on this.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
No worries. And once I get that fixed, I'll bring it by. And
yeah, and
just
thank
drop
you
off
also.
The front desk and
I had sent you that email about tracking some of that data, and I appreciate you looking into that. Thank
oh,
you
absolutely.
For doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. It will help out. So.
Yeah, because when we had MindSprings here, and we sort of asked them, how many prisoners do you see? And we didn't really have that information. So if that could be included in that report, that would be really
sure,
helpful.
Sure, absolutely.
Us. Yeah, thank you very much
I
for that.
I appreciate it. Have a good
one. So we're going to discuss the USDA forest modification. Number three, the participating agreement first.
Okay. And here the Greg Brown, Rock County Weed Program Supervisor, we are presenting to the commissioners for signature the modification three of the current U.S. Forest Service participating agreement for weed control in the Bears Ears, Hunts Peak District U.S. Forest Service weed management work. And the only two differences from the previous modification are the additional funding of $1,960 to meet the intended work plan of 2019, and also a change in our administrative contact at the Laramie office of the Route Medicine Bow National Forest.
Has this agreement been reviewed by legal, or
yeah,
does it?
Yeah, it was last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does it need to? Do we need?
Yeah, you should really look at it every year.
Okay.
Should he? Okay. Okay.
We can. I mean, we can. I can sign it after he takes a look
okay,
at it. Yeah,
okay.
That's fine. And I know that they need to track all the contracts and
they do
whatever. So
yeah. Sue always sends me a list of active contracts to see what's available. So that's
okay.
Good. Ready for a motion?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve and authorize your signature on the proposed modification to the current participating agreement with the USDA Forest Service.
I would modify the motion to, sorry, amend the motion to after legal has reviewed this agreement and signed off on it.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you. I will.
You have to second.
Second, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
So just have him stamp it and then bring it back.
Okay.
And I'll sign it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's no problem.
Get that there.
And then let's discuss the Taylor Grazing Funds.
Okay. We're asking the commissioners to approve the recommendation from the Rock County Weed Advisory Board to grant the expenditure of $10,000, not to exceed $10,000, for the spraying of acres previously treated on leafy spurge infested lands west of Hayden, contiguous to the Yampa River, south of US 40, and lands near and contiguous to the state land south of the rest area on US 40, and to authorize the payment of $500 to help offset the cost of landowner letter, landowner contact letters in association with the leafy spurge project.
Is the total amount $10,000 or $10,500?
$10,500. Okay. $10,000, I mean, it came out to be just, I think last year it was $10,200 was the invoice amount. So we don't have anything specific to sign, but approval for the commissioners to pay the invoices up to that amount on the Leafy Spurge project spraying.
Ben, would you like to say anything about the project? I was at the board meeting, so why don't you come on up and tell us a little bit about it?
I would like to thank the Weed Board and the commissioners for supporting the Emperor Relief Experience Project. And I think if we could just keep on moving forward, and maybe someday we'll find a way to deal with this. I think there's a lot of energy out there, and there's going to be more so.
In reviewing the previous efforts on leafy spurge control, going back some 20-plus years, we're not the first ones to try to do this. But I think we've stayed together longer, at least looking through the documents that are in the files. It looks like the effort has stayed together and focused and with some energy longer than it has before. And I think it's important for Rapp County to use the resources that are available through the Range Improvement Fund. It allows the use of that money to something that's potentially beneficial to prevent an adverse incident occurring on contiguous rangelands. And Moffitt County has been supporting it from their general fund. But it gives us an opportunity to use the Range Improvement Funds for what I think is a legitimate purpose.
Well, I think that's key, what you just said, the idea that we're going to work to prevent what could be a much, much larger problem. Knowing the examples of what have happened in North Dakota and areas of Wyoming, this could be a really big deal. And I'd just like to acknowledge Ben Bell's work keeping this group together for, almost 3 years now? Meeting on a regular basis and keeping the energy going. And finally, with this grant from the roundtable and the involvement of the University of Wyoming, it feels like we might actually be figuring out a way to actually do something instead of just nipping around the edges, that we're beginning to look at something that's a little bit more holistic of a solution. So and thank you for that.
There may be some good things out there that happen. The professor from the University of Wyoming said he's talked to some of the chemical manufacturers. It could be a new herbicide coming out. And I just got an email. I think it's $500,000 the Forest Service gave Carbon County.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
And they have a whole, they were talking about some mixtures of chemicals. So I'll send it to
was that to the extent that maybe they now had something that could be used in the riparian areas, or is it still
that up? That's
the extent.
I just read this thing from John Husband. He talked to one of his old contacts from up there, BLM. And I'll send this thing, I'll send it to Greg, because it's a mixture of different chemicals and a certain kind of so many ounces per whatever.
Because there are things that we have been able to use in the riparian zone, even over high water tables and right immediately adjacent to the water of the YAMP as it flows by. But they're not the most effective chemicals. And we've been careful to manage the chemicals that we can use so that we don't develop resistance in those populations. So we've been changing chemicals year to year. Well, we're really doing that because there are so few that we can use there. If we get into upland sites, and there are some areas out there where we've been able to use the chemical Tordon, or the brand name Tordon, the chemical picloram, to treat on areas where, based upon our knowledge of where the water table is relative to vegetation that's occurring there. There are some places where we've been able to use Tordon. They're minuscule in terms of what's potentially treatable out in the riparian areas. So
you know, Commissioner Melton was invited to go on the Friends of the Yampa River trip this year, so she may have the opportunity to see some of the outcroppings of the leafy spurge. Depending, last year when I went, it wasn't really blooming. We didn't see very much.
You can take pictures if you want.
Yeah. Who knows?
No, don't take pictures. Pull them.
The monument is really getting into it.
I did not have any appreciation of weed management before coming here, and I really appreciate you. It was interesting to be at the Weed Board and to hear the discussion about ranchlands being just abandoned, mm-hmm. you know, because of these kinds of outbreaks. So I think it's a whole new world for me. But
you weren't the first one as a commissioner to learn those.
Who knew? But I now appreciate and understand how important this is. So thank
you. Do we have
you.
A date for the Show Me Float yet?
We have 21st.
Of?
And it's going to be 2 days, so we'll have a night.
Oh, we're going to do June. It on 21st of
it's
June.
It's going to be in Little Yampa Canyon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So.
Oh, I'm looking for. I've never floated that.
Great. Okay, great. So bring your boat.
I will.
Boat.
Yeah. All right.
All right. June.
All right.
You ready for a motion?
I'm ready.
Madam Chair, I would move to accept the recommendation of the Rao County Weed Advisory Board and approve the funding of $10,500 for the Yampa River Leafy Spurge Project.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, it's already on my calendar.
Absolutely.
Introduce to Julie Hughes from Chandler Asset Management.
Nice to see you, Julie.
Nice to see you. Hi,
nice to see you, Trader. Nice to see
you, too. Julie.
So Julie's just going to give you a presentation of our investment portfolio for the first quarter of 2019.
Don't worry, I won't go through every detail.
How much time do we have?
I think till noon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Well, I will start with a brief economic update just to provide some context for the investment environment and the market and the economy in which we are investing. And it's not meant to be a monologue necessarily, so please ask questions along the way. I'm going to start on page 3 and just highlight a couple comments I always like to start with about the Fed, because the Fed is really the primary determinant of short-term interest rates and where we're investing the county's funds. So Fed policy really dictates the short end of the curve and where these monies are being invested in fixed income. So the Fed met in March, and it was an extremely dovish statement and press conference and message. Dovish meaning not very likely to raise rates anytime in the near future. So it was a pretty dramatic shift from the December meeting. We've been a rising rate environment for the last almost 4 years now, with very gradual rate increases. And the December meeting and their economic projections showed potentially another 2 rate hikes this year. Shifted dramatically in March, and their projections are now showing no rate hikes this year, maybe only one next year, and none in the horizon that they were forecasting. And that was really due to a slowing global economy. So in a nutshell, our whole interest rate outlook has shifted based on really the last 6 months. The market has really changed, and growth around the globe, the Eurozone, China, most major markets are slowing. They're still growing, but it's slower. So that is a backdrop. If we look at page 4 here, the Fed has a dual mandate. So primarily what they're looking at is maximum employment and stable prices. And if we look at the employment picture here, non-farm payroll growth on your left here has been very strong for the last several years, trending at about 200,000 jobs per month being created, which is more than enough to support new entrants to the labor force. We had a blip here in February, some volatility around the government shutdown earlier this year, but you can see that's rebounded, and 1 point does not make a trend. The trend is very strong. We still have 3.8% unemployment. Underemployment has declined as well. And the one piece of the puzzle that's really been lagging has been wage growth. And wage growth is finally starting to pick up. So we clocked about 3.2% in the last month, year over year, which is still relatively weak, historically speaking, for this low level of unemployment. But it is finally moving in the right direction.
Does that raise the prospect of inflation? Or the likelihood?
If it were actually to pick up to a more historically normal level.
Of wage growth?
It would.
Yep.
Yes, but we really haven't seen it. It's been very slow to come around. So it really should be between 3.5% and 4% for this low level of unemployment.
And if it continued at 3.5% or 4%, then the Fed would have to worry about inflation.
They would certainly have to pay very close attention to that, which really leads right into the next slide, which is the inflation slide, the stable price component of their mandate. So there's two measures here, CPI and PCE. The Fed prefers the personal consumption expenditures index on the right. It tends to be more dynamic than the CPI, and it runs a little below typically the CPI. So there's two lines here. There's a core and a headline. Your headline, you see, is the more volatile one, and that's the green line. And you can see that includes food and energy. So energy being the big drop-off here that you see. The core is less volatile. That's the dark gray line. And the Fed is looking for around a 2% number for that core PCE index. And as you can see, it's hit it a few months, but it's really trending at about 1.8%. So continues to be just below the Fed's target. Now, to your point, if we did finally start to see some wage growth, that should move the needle on this. And they have said they are willing to let this run a little bit hot, so a little over 2%, before they would take action. So I think we're probably, you know, everybody's been so worried about inflation with all the quantitative easing and so forth that we've had, but it just really hasn't come to fruition.
So if inflation started to run hot, would the Fed, would that give them motivation to raise interest rates?
They could.
To slow things down.
Yes, exactly. That is typically how they react to that.
And maybe off subject, but is the Fed concerned about the level of federal debt? I mean, I'm sure they're concerned about it, but how does that factor into their thinking?
Let's flip to page 11. So this isn't federal debt, but it's related.
Okay.
So they built up their balance sheet after 2008, the financial crisis. They did all this quantitative easing and bought all these bonds, bought all these mortgages, bought all these agencies and treasuries, and built up the biggest balance sheet they've ever had at over $4.3 trillion. So there has been an effort to wind down that balance sheet over the last year or so, to the tune of about $150 billion per quarter. They just announced in March that they will stop winding down the balance sheet at the end of September. So we expect it to be around $3.5 to $4 trillion still, which is pretty massive.
What was it before the?
It was around two.
Okay.
It was below this chart.
Okay.
So nobody really expects it to go back down to that level. We did expect it to come down further than it will. And that's just another tool in their toolkit. So,
right.
So that is related also to how much federal debt we have. And I think that is somewhat concerning, especially as they have to service this debt, right? And that is certainly a consideration that they don't talk about, but I think is fundamental to what is realistic.
Okay. Thank you.
That makes sense. So... back to page 6, just looking at the consumer, because that's about 2/3 of our economy. Retail sales, we had some weakness here in the last few months. Surprisingly, e-commerce is only about 10% of this total number, but this also includes some big ticket items like motor vehicles. It includes gasoline sales, things like that. So you do get volatility. Overall, the consumer is still very strong, and it's what's driving our economic growth. We do have some volatility around the government shutdown time as well, as you can see. But overall, historically speaking, we're in good shape as far as consumer confidence and spending. And on page 7, these are two very broad indicators, if you will, of economic activity, both on a forward-looking or leading basis. And they're both, you can see There's been a bit of a declining trend in both of these indices, but they are both pointing toward moderate growth, slower growth going forward in the economy. Just to give you some perspective, the index on the right, the CFNAI, if this were to go down to a negative 0.7, that would be indicative of an oncoming recession. So it's not even on our chart. It's nowhere near that level. It's just showing that we should see slower growth going forward, which really is consistent with everything else we read out there. Housing on page 8, which has really been a driver of economic growth, you can see the precipitous decline in the 20-city Case-Shiller price index. So really for about the last year and a half, we have started to see growth in housing prices fall off, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So we're still at about 3.6% growth in housing prices and all these markets combined year over year. Some of the very overheated markets like Seattle, San Francisco, have actually started to see some declines. San Diego, Colorado still tends to be pretty strong, although those numbers have come down from a peak of over 9% to just under 6% now. I don't know what you guys are seeing here locally in the county.
I'd say every bit of that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I don't think we've seen the declines, have we?
Not declines in prices. I don't know.
Or even declines on the rate of growth. I mean, I think we're probably, my guess is we're running closer to 10% year over year. Okay. Just that's anecdotal. You know,
sure.
Just looking at what, my wife is a real estate broker.
Okay.
She took me for a ride last night when we were looking at houses and how much they cost, and I was pretty shocked.
Yeah. Well, it's always interesting to hear what's going on locally. So perhaps it will lag. Coming to the county here, but Colorado just in general tends to be stronger than the nation as a whole, and tends not to have as big of boom and bust, generally speaking. So just so you guys are aware of what's going on nationally there. On the next page, manufacturing, really just about 10% of the economy, but still a bellwether to keep an eye on. It's still definitely in the expansion zone, and production is still at higher levels. So there's still room. There's still a little bit of slack there, but still a healthy sector from that standpoint. And really everything adds up to GDP on page 10 here. And we can see 2018, we have all four quarters here. Fourth quarter came in a little bit slower than projected at 2.2%. That followed very, very strong quarters prior, and the whole year ended up right at about 3% growth. So we're projecting, and most economists are projecting, about 2 to 2.5% for 2019. So again, it's not a screeching halt. It's no need for panic, but it is projected to slow down. And you can see the top line here, the consumer is really what's been driving the growth. And as long as people continue to be employed, that should continue to be the case.
But the effects of the tax cut have mostly...
are waning.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's a lot of uncertainty globally with Brexit, the tariffs, what kind of impact that's going to ultimately have, just slowing growth everywhere. Is really impacting, you know, the U.S. economy. It's so intertwined now as well. So we talked about the Fed's balance sheet. You can flip to page 12 and see where rate levels are. So really rubber meets the road, where we're able to invest in securities for and in the portfolio for the county. You can see the trend here on the left. Rate levels peaked about September, October last year, and when equities sold off dramatically in the fourth quarter, we saw a big flight to quality into treasuries and much lower yield levels. And then the Fed came in March with their big dovish statement, and you can see rate levels dipped even further. So we've recovered slightly from that, but unless the global economy changes its course, and unless we see a dramatic shift we are probably in a lower rate environment, perhaps stable, perhaps even declining. Fed funds futures, which is really market participants, are showing about 50% probability for a rate cut at the end of toward the end of the year. We think it's more likely that rates will remain stable, but, you know.
What's the difference between a Treasury note yield and just the U.S. Treasury yield curve? Or are they telling us two different things?
Yes and no. So on the chart on the left, you have the 2-year, the 5-year, mm-hmm. and the 10-year. And this is just showing you at various points in time,
right. I understand that.
What those yields are. The yield curve is telling us all across the curve, from 3 months all the way out to 30 years, and at three specific points in time here.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank
you. So the latest and greatest on the right here is the inverted curve you see at the end of March. It's the burgundy line. So 3-month Treasury is at about a 240, right at about where Fed funds mm-hmm. are. The 2-year today is right at about a 241, and the 5-year is about 2 basis points under that.
Which is inverted.
Inverted. Now, the 10-year is higher at a 259. So it's typically when we see between 3 months and 10 years, when that's inverted, that historically speaking has led us to an oncoming recession. It did happen for a couple of weeks there, and it has corrected itself. So our firm doesn't think we're headed toward a recession in the next 6 months. However, that being said, it does tell us something in terms of outlook for the economy. And globally as well, you know, we have a 10-year German Bund, which is trading at about zero right now. It went negative, might be positive a few basis points, but that compared to the 10-year Treasury at a 259 is, you know, quite favorable for investors to invest in the 10-year, but it's putting a lid or a cap on the long-term rates here as well. So that gives you an idea about where we're investing, kind of in that 240 range, give or take. Any other questions at all?
No, this is my favorite part of the presentation. The global outlook is really helpful. Thank you. Great.
All right, well, let's take a look at the portfolio then. Starting on page 14, just a quick review of the objectives, always starting with safety, liquidity, followed by a commensurate rate of return. And we are measuring our performance as a manager against a benchmark index, which is the 2-year held-to-maturity treasury index. And the strategy is really to invest in fixed income instruments that are commensurate with your policy and Colorado revised statutes.
Not very exciting.
Not very exciting. And it shouldn't be. No Bitcoin, no Tesla. All pretty vanilla stuff. So on page 15, this is a statement of compliance. We do check compliance with your policy and statute before and after every trade, the end of every month, and the quarter. So everything is currently in compliance for first quarter. And on page 16, we can take a look at the characteristics of the portfolio. As of the end of March, that's the middle column here, we had a modified duration and average maturity of about 3/4 of a year. Which was a little bit short of the benchmark of 1 year. Now, we've purposely been trying to stay short the benchmark because we've been in a rising rate environment, and that protects your principal. We got a little bit surprised by such a big rate decline in the fourth quarter and sort of a new environment here.
Yes, we did, didn't we?
I do not know one professional manager that was not surprised. So you're certainly not alone in that. That being said, given the new outlook that we have, we'd like to gradually move that duration closer to neutral with the benchmark, which is a way to manage returns in a more stable or falling rate environment. So you'll see that get gradually longer and closer to that benchmark as time goes on here. You can see the purchase yield has increased to 221. And the market yield at a 242, which is favorable to the benchmark. You can see how that's declined over the last quarter. That's what we don't have control over. That's the market itself. We have control over the purchase yield to some extent, but not that market yield. The quality is that of the U.S. government, AA+ and AAA, and market value at $23,617,000. You can see we invested an additional $3 million over the quarter for the direction of the treasurer. And taking a look at more detail about the portfolio on page 17, this is the sector distribution. So we had about 29% treasuries and about 67% agencies with one position of commercial paper, which is Toyota, which is the highest rated commercial paper that you can buy out there. So slight shift from last quarter, mainly in the commercial paper, and we saw more value in agencies. I don't expect this to shift much quarter to quarter. It just depends on if we can get adequate spread in agencies or not, and that changes all the time. So looking at page 18, the portfolio is very well diversified between issuers. So U.S. government at the top of the list here with the various agencies, and a good allocation to each, and then the one position to Toyota. Anything that is commercial paper will always be less than 5% per your policy and per Colorado statute. And super exciting on page 19, the quality distribution, everything is AA and AAA. The green bars are that of the county, the gray bars are the counties from prior quarter, and everything will always be AA and AAA. Unless the U.S. government is downgraded, which is a whole another conversation we would be having.
Let's not have that conversation.
Yeah, we need to have that conversation.
Avoid that.
And on page 20, this is the duration distribution. So this is where the securities lie between 0 and 2 years, essentially. And you can see the shift from December to March here. We did add some exposure in the 1 to 2 year part of the curve. So typically we'll buy out there and let it roll down, and we'll buy out to the longer end and let it roll down. We're typically holding to maturity. So that is the slight change from quarter to quarter. And on page 21, this is the total return performance over various time periods. So the green bar then being that of the county, the gray bar being the 2-year held to maturity index. And as you can see, the performance for various periods, the intent is to be very close to the benchmark. If we were way outperforming or way underperforming, it would mean we were taking on too much risk or not taking enough risk. So our goal is to outperform over time. So since inception, there is a slight outperformance. And we will be increasing that duration to meet the benchmark duration to increase the performance over the benchmark over time. This includes not only your interest income component or your yield, this is also the underlying price changes in the securities of the portfolio. So big change in the market, right? As as yields shifted downward, that was good for the prices in the securities, but now we're buying at lower yields. So there's an offsetting impact there. If you want to just look at the interest income generation of the portfolio, the next page does that. There's an upward trajectory to that of that purchase yield, and that will still go up, actually, just by virtue of those older securities rolling off that were purchased at lower yields. And everything we're buying now is in that 240 range. And that really concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions. The rest of this is just holdings and transactions. We have made a couple purchases in April in the 2-year part of the curve at around a 240 yield. So moving that duration more towards the benchmark slightly.
So total portfolio, page 25.
So the managed portfolio that we're working with you guys on page 26, make sure consolidated here. Sorry, page 24. page 25, excuse me, I'm sorry, $23,617,000.
Okay, that's the total portfolio that you are managing.
Correct, and then if you include the items on page 26, which is the CDs and the local government investment pools, that's another $19.2 million.
And
then there's a consolidated piece.
So out of all of these, maybe Lane can better answer this question, what of this is really liquid? Or what's the more liquid portion?
So the local government investment pools are liquid within 24 hours.
Okay. The stuff that you're managing is basically not liquid.
It's liquid in that every security is extremely liquid because it's treasuries and agencies. If Lane called us today and said, I need you to sell something, I need $5 million, we could go sell it today. Now,
we take a penalty.
Maybe. Depends on where rates are. So
okay.
There may be a penalty, there may be a gain, there may be a loss. Our goal would be to mitigate that as best we can. And we can see...
But even at the worst-case scenario, there would never be a huge loss.
No, I mean...
I mean, it would be in the 1% range.
If you look at the various holdings in the report here, you can see there's plenty of positions at losses and there's plenty of positions at gains we could sell.
Okay.
And that's your third...
You can choose which ones
exactly.
to sell.
Exactly. That's your third column from the right. And that varies day to day. So we can pick and choose, and typically we can get close to a zero impact
okay.
on that. But everything's extremely liquid, very large market.
But if Lane needed to move some cash, she would start down on the local.
Yes, because that's dollar in, dollar out.
And okay. we do that daily.
Right.
With the local investment pools, we...
Sounds like we're tracking pretty close to where we would expect to track, should I say? Right?
Yeah, you know, it's, I think, a little bit more challenging than it has been in the last 4 years. We have, you know, changed our strategy also, so.
Well, the market's done pretty good since you took office.
Yeah.
Nice job.
yeah. But I think it's also been kind of a challenging market with the inverted curve and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
strategic-wise, we've been you know, changing how we've been investing the last 4 years.
Right. And, you know, stock market has done great. It's rebounded dramatically in the first quarter.
It's pretty much back to where it was prior to the downturn. Yeah.
It is. Rate levels are just lower. So that's challenging, right. certainly. Long-term, we have to keep a long-term perspective. Maintaining a disciplined strategy, historically speaking, has paid off in the long run, even if on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't always get us excited and we don't right. always, you know.
Yeah, I'd rather answer to our constituents that we're only making 1% than we found out we lost 20%.
Right. Well, and I think the nature of our investments protects us from that.
Yep.
Well, my understanding of this is only slightly higher than of weed management, so maybe next time around I'll be able to ask some more intelligent questions.
But yeah, I would say that this
I think Chandler does a good job of laying
yeah,
it out for us,
absolutely.
Though, so we don't have to think a lot about it.
Yeah.
It's basically all right there.
Well, it's all really interesting. It's just not anything I feel like I know a lot about, so thank you. That was really
pleasure. Well, and again, I think that the overview of what's happening out there, the global economies, it's important for us as commissioners to, you know, at least have some kind of an understanding. When things happen, we
right.
have some understanding of why. I don't know how much we really get to prepare, but, I mean, if we really knew that there was a recession on the horizon, it was, you know, we would be taking that into account as we build our budget.
Right.
But
No one really
you can't
knows.
Really make any promises to us. So.
No one really knows. If we had the crystal ball, boy, I'd be on a beach.
I was invited to join a meeting when the Fed is in town in a couple of weeks.
The Fed's going to be in town?
Well, I don't know. Somebody from the Fed. Yeah. How do they use the information from those meetings in doing these things? Does anyone know? It was like business, outlook, conversation.
One several years ago, and trying to get the pulse of the local economy, of a resort community. I think they might make tours of resort communities because they're nice places to go.
But those are employees. It's not the Federal Reserve Board itself.
These are not the board itself.
Liaisons or
the heads of the, I guess. Kansas City Fed.
Could be from the Kansas City Fed.
Oh,
that would be
okay.
I just didn't know. I was like, wow, this sounds like.
Because usually.
I don't know.
The whole board, they typically meet in Jackson Hole. They're not going to.
They don't want to come around. No, I think it was like a I don't even understand how the Fed works. That's how little I know about this. But
before they had been, or the quarter before they had been in Jackson Hole. So, again, they make a tour.
So they like us, too.
They probably want to gather local data and maybe share state-related or a region. Like they'll share from the district, the region perspective. Possibly.
Yes, it's from the Bank of Kansas City.
Yeah.
And this person's name is Allison Felix.
Should be
roundtable conversation and information gained is shared with the Fed's regional president to help her understand the concerns of business leaders. Just curious.
I'm really excited.
Well, I don't know what they think they're going to learn from me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was good to see you.
Yes,
again.
You too.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Nice to meet you. Yeah.
See you, Lane.
Thank you.
Keep up the good. And get started.
We'd like to go with the P-Bear liner, if that's
yes,
okay.
Yes, please do.
RFP 639. So we can get Scott on his way. So we are here for consideration for approval by the Board of County Commissioners and authorization of the chair to sign the professional services agreement with RG and Associates to provide task 4 construction phase services of the SOW, the statement of work dated 9/12/16, and approval for the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order in the amount of $34,819 for compliance with current lagoon seepage standards for the Phippsburg Water Treatment Facility.
Do you have any information you want to add?
Well, we've been working on this since actually before 2016, before I got here. There's been a series of grants and loans. First was a DOLA grant to evaluate the system following a compliance notification from the state about seepage, that we weren't meeting seepage requirements. They have clay liners at those lagoons. And so when I got here, we had that grant and went out for bid to find a vendor to do that evaluation. RG was the vendor that we selected. And then the professional services agreement that we signed with them was to do that work. It wasn't specifically for the construction phase work. Just wanted to leave that open-ended in case we ended up having problems with the contractor. Mm-hmm. But they've been okay for the most part. The person that I originally worked with moved on and worked for another company, but they've been able to keep it up. And so we have a new professional services agreement for construction phase work. So it's engineering, construction phase engineering. So basically they did the design, and they're going to ensure that the construction proceeds according to the design. And so that was part of the scope of work that they put together for the entire project, task 1, 2, 3, and 4. This is the final task. And the project is being paid for partly with a DOLA grant, $150,000, partly with a low-interest loan that I think it was about
$124,200.
And also part, it was $300,000 more or less total. Part of that was for the design and engineering grant that is now closed. And so now we're moving on to the final phase at last, the last grant and loan, and hopefully we're done with all this stuff for a while. And just as an update, we went out for bid for a contractor to do the actual construction.
Yeah, I guess that was the missing part.
Yep. And so...
we'll be back.
Just a small piece.
Right. So we get those bids back around the middle of next week.
Yeah, it said that in here, I think, right?
But we'll evaluate those upon our return, and we'll hopefully get some good proposals and be able to move forward with construction to replace the liners this summer.
So this was was this put out some kind of a competitive bid originally, and this is just
yes,
the last
exactly.
phase that they're now.
That's correct.
They
so
wanted
to leave
to proceed
it open-ended.
That's why
to
we
to give us the flexibility to go out for competitive bid for this part of the work, but I think that they've been doing a good job, and they have knowledge of the project, they do the design, and so I think in this case the continuity is important. If something would have happened in the process somewhere, we weren't happy with them, we wanted the flexibility to choose another contractor. But
and when they bid, did they bid on all of the phases? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
In other words, this...
Well,
this
I guess they put together a cost estimate, and we based the grant, so it's not exactly what you said. They put together a cost estimate, and we based the grants and the loans and went through this, you know, detailed evaluation process. And so they didn't really do a bid, but rather that cost estimate that was evaluated, and so it's still stands, that cost estimate still stands a couple years later.
So we've budgeted $274,000 for the entire project.
That's right.
And we already spent how much in their first phase?
About 26.
Okay. And now
and that was for to do the design and
correct.
Engineering and to assist with bidding.
And then now we're going to pay them $34,000 for what is in essence construction management?
Yes.
So it just feels, honestly, it, you know, feels a little out of whack that construction management would cost more than the engineering and design phase, and then 34. It's about $34,000 to supervise what presumably will be approximately a $200,000 construction contract.
Right, but there's some requirements that we have included. Engineering oversight as specified in Task 4. So, do you have Task 4 available there?
We have those, yeah.
I should, yeah.
And so it might help just to read in detail what's involved in Task 4. And nothing has ever come up with the Colorado Water and Power Authority or DOLA.
Okay, and they would be
yeah,
reviewing
they would
this
everything.
And this was funded with DOLA money and...
A low interest loan.
From
Colorado Water and Power Authority.
So there must be some federal money flowing through because I see there's Davis-Bacon requirements.
That's right.
Correct.
Okay, well, that explains why all this costs so much.
Okay.
How it works.
Yeah, there's.
I think it's also the mobilization of their construction crews and their, you know, oversight.
And a learning experience for all.
Okay.
How long till this project is done, then? What's the timeline on this?
Well, the construction season, as you know, is short. I anticipate that they'll be able to start breaking ground probably near the beginning or mid-July. And I think that the timeline has them working for about 3 months. But the idea is that you get out of Dodge by November 1st.
Yeah.
And then I think that we had December 31st to close out the project, but we just did it to the end of the year, so we didn't have to move that date in case there were any delays.
All right.
It's also complicated because you have to keep the facility operating.
Right.
That is complicated. I didn't see a legal stamp on here. Has legal reviewed it?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect.
It's on here.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay.
We like legal stamps.
Pardon me?
We like legal stamps. Oh,
I can't understand all that mumbo jumbo. Somebody, that's what we pay him for.
Eric's my best friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yes, absolutely.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve and authorize your signature on the professional services agreement with RG and Associates to provide task 4 construction phase services of the schedule of work dated 9/12/16 and approval. Is that what the SOW stands for? Schedule of work?
Scope of work.
Scope of work.
Always means scope of work to me.
Okay.
Or statement of work.
Yeah. Dated 9/12/16 and approval for the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order in the amount of $34,819 for compliance with current lagoon seepage standards for the Phippsburg Water Treatment Facility.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right.
All right. We'll see you shortly.
I'll email it to you.
Okay.
All right.
Striping
yes.
is what we have next.
All right. this request is for the Board of County Commissioners to approve and award the Route County Road and Bridge Department 2019 striping project to Straight Stripe Painting Incorporated in the amount not to exceed $159,974.50. And we went out for bid to 11 suppliers, and 2 suppliers responded. And this purchase meets the standards and adheres to the policies for Section 6.7 of the Route County Purchasing Manual, 6th edition, Request for Proposal, Policy, and Procedures.
This is our yearly striping project. All of the roads just about in Route County that have centered line stripe or side stripes get repainted. We're going to skip a couple roads that were still in pretty decent condition in order to meet the budget.
Which we've met.
Which we have met. Straight
like 26
stripe.
Bucks.
Nice work.
Straight Stripe has been working with us for the last 3 years, I believe, and they do a great job. So this is just a regular maintenance every year.
How did the unit prices compare to last year?
They were higher. They were
which is why you cut back.
Paint has gone up considerably.
Yeah, it was almost a dollar higher per gallon.
The cost,
yes.
The cost for the paint itself.
Yes.
How about the
mobilization? I think it was the same.
The mobilization in that was the same. It was strictly just the material cost that had risen so much.
Yeah. So we are not going to do 17 and 15. I want to take them out.
Of course, really, that's a combined price of the labor and the material. So
right.
The paint price might be the same.
It could be
their,
well,
their
but,
labor and equipment.
But in the tabulation, the difference was the price per gallon.
Okay.
Yeah.
On the paint.
This company really has always done a really good job, and they've had this. It's gone back and forth between two.
It's between two,
vendors.
But they have it for the last 3 years, or 2 years at least.
Yeah. So for next year, you'll be increasing the budget accordingly to
correct
to a price that would use this year's pricing to do the whole.
Yes.
I think they take a 5-year average and they try to look at it that way.
I mean, Dan has his magical spreadsheets, but I usually, I have to tell him how much we're going to need, but then he tweaks it a little bit, which sometimes does not work in our favor. But this one came up pretty close. We were.
How many miles of road did we exclude in order to make budget?
7.
7 miles. Okay. Great. What road was that?
15 and 17.
15 and 17, yeah. They don't get that much traffic. Yeah, they
look good. I figured they were the lowest traffic that are paid.
Good call.
And they still look pretty good. Yeah. Went and drove it on.
I brought that up a couple of years ago, that we shouldn't just automatically paint every single road. I mean, there's some of them that look just fine.
So a lot of them look good during the day. But it's the retro reflectivity of the glass beads in the paint that, you know, help people see in the snow and at night.
And it's pretty when they get wet.
Right. So
sometimes
we...
I hadn't heard that before.
In
that's
the day,
interesting.
They look great. Because they have glass beads in the paint. So they, with your light, it
reflects. So, yeah. You ready?
Good to know. I'm very ready.
All right. Madam Chair, I would move to approve the award and authorize your signature on the notice of award and associated contract documents and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order for the 2019 striping project to Stripe Painting, Inc. in the amount of not to exceed $159,974.50.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Dust abatement?
Dust abatement.
Great.
This request is to approve and award the contract for the 2019 dust abatement project to the lowest responsible bidder, GMCO Corporation, in the amount not to exceed $579,200 for the Route County Road and Bridge Department. This was budgeted at $580,000, and it's coming from two different funding sources. One dust retardant for the county and one not for the county.
Which is paid by private citizens.
Paid by private.
No, explain that.
Say that again.
There's two line items. And
The one that's dust retardant not for the county is
right.
What we do for private citizens.
Correct.
And that'll generate rent. They'll pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we buy it in bulk and sell it back.
We
to
buy
them.
In bulk.
Exactly.
We actually apply it for them only on county roads that are non-maintained. Or we don't apply.
The private owners pay us.
Yeah.
Yes. Private owners pay us to apply on a public road that we don't manage.
Would not otherwise have. Yeah.
Right. So you can see then the history that we've gone back and forth with two vendors on this, and both responded to this. So we feel that we've, by taking the responsible bidder, the lowest bid for the IFB process, we're following the policy procedure.
Again, this is our yearly dust abatement project. We do it every year. 800,000 gallons. We are not changing the volume. But we are going to be switching some roads that we have been continuously doing. We're going to try to do some other ones that we have not, like Eagles Watch. We're going to do that. That's in the Stagecoach area.
Yep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That should be very exciting for them.
So a lot of citizens that usually pay, they were very relieved this year that they don't have to pay. We're going to do that.
So what was the criteria that we used to?
Well, if we'd re-gravel mostly.
Okay.
We put fresh gravel. We want to keep the dust down because the fresh gravel, as you know, comes up right out of the pit with a bunch of fines.
So that road may not otherwise have met the threshold for daily traffic.
So on Eagles Watch, it's a little bit complicated because it has two roads.
Yep.
Talon, Broken Talon,
mm-hmm.
and I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah, I know.
But
there's
both
a main
converge.
One that goes around right. that has most of the traffic.
Right.
And
they both converge into 212.
Right.
So 212 actually meets the threshold for MAC. But the two independently don't.
Did not.
So we usually MAC all the way to the intersection.
Right.
And then we don't do that.
Yeah, it's been a sore subject up there for a
yes.
long time.
Yeah. So we're going to do that again.
Again, we did it last year.
We did it last year. We put fresh gravel last year, so we did it immediately after that.
Okay.
And we're going to do it again just to make sure that it stays in there. But the volume is the same as every other year.
But I mean, we're making a longer-term commitment now, correct?
Well, people could get used to...
I mean, there's no guarantee that you'll do it next year.
There's no guarantee that we'll
okay.
do it.
Okay.
Yeah, because as we don't do other places, and we may add gravel to other places, we want to make sure that we treat that gravel, because otherwise it'll the fines especially will fly off.
Right.
And want to stay on the ground.
Right.
But a GMCO, it's a great contractor. Actually, the guys like working with them better.
There were some issues last year, right?
There were
perceived
a
issues.
Perceived issues, I believe. Yeah. The guys really like working GMCO. They feel like the applications are better and more efficient. And some, you know, they can cover the like turns and corners better than the other side.
It did, you know, I mean, just looking at some of the roads last year, it kind of felt like they didn't get, it was like a narrower band. You know,
they have two different types of trucks, sprayer trucks. So GMCO has like a big tanker that covers everything at once.
Oh.
Whereas GMCO has a smaller tanker that goes half and half.
Okay.
So sometimes they say, you know, there is no overlap.
Of course, we also didn't know last year it was so dry.
Well, last year it was dry, and mag needs moisture.
Right. But you guys go out and water the roads in advance, don't you?
In advance, yes. Yes.
Right. Well,
it's a regular project. But, yeah, so we prepare. We rip up the roads just about the top 6 inches, spray mag chloride, and then we reform everything and then roll it.
Do we roll every one of our mag chloride?
We are now. So we have those new walk and roll
behind
the graders.
We're behind the graders.
So as they roll it, they compact it with it.
When did we start using that? Two years ago? Yeah. Good. All right. You ready?
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, I would move to authorize your signature on the notice of award and associated contracts. I'm authorized the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order for the 2019 dust abatement project to GMCO Corporation for 72.4 cents per gallon, not to exceed $579,200.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Chip sealing is what I have next.
That's fine. We're going in order.
Sounds good.
We're here to request the Board of County Commissioners approve and authorize the chair to sign the notice of award and associated contract documents and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order for the 2019 chip seal project to GMCO LLC in the amount not to exceed $447,583.38. This has been funded. You might want to explain the funding.
We're having funding from two different sources in the same org, I guess. So it's all under maintenance. But one is going to be chip seal, and then the other one is leveling. When we prepared the budget, we had a number for chip seal that was changed somehow. And so we are using the leveling budget, which we don't have any leveling this year, to compensate for the amount that we don't have in the chip seal budget.
If you look at the background information, it's again, the budget was prepared based on a five-year average, and since there wasn't any in 2016, it really brought that average down.
Oh, okay.
So that's where this little issue came up about the budgeting for this project. And so we were able to find, with finance's help, the $221,520 that had been approved for leveling. And rather than not do as much chip seal as we wanted, we took off a few of the anyway, we're able to complete the project that needs to be done and not come back for a supplemental budget.
So this additional money that was available out of leveling is it a result of the fact that we're doing less overlays this year, or just because of the overlays we're going to do this year don't require as much leveling?
The overlays that we are doing this year do not require leveling.
Okay.
But somehow accounting had this leveling line item was funded for this year, so I don't know.
Was funded.
That was funded.
It seems like this five-year average might not be working for this specific line item, because I'm looking at, well, no, I'm looking at this history. I mean, it's 1 year it was 700,000, 1 year it was zero, 1 year it was 89,000-ish, and 1 year it was 247. I mean, an average doesn't seem like it's going to work for that line item.
Ray called me up and told me.
Okay.
Actually, he and Gio told me about it last week, or maybe it was.
Yep. We came up to explain this ahead of time.
Yeah, it was. He said that Ray understands that once the
accounting is bringing their budget to you all, that he needs to look at it again before it goes too far to make sure that the mm-hmm. right amount is in there.
Because the problem is that we don't chip seal the same number of miles of roads every 7 years.
So
some years you're doing a bunch, and some years you're not doing very much. So you're right. Five-year averaging system doesn't work.
When I presented to the board my the amount that I wanted when we were in, I was off for like
$3,000. Yes.
And then somehow when I was...
When you weren't looking.
And they went down $100,000.
And then the bids came in.
And then the bids came in.
Well, that's fine.
But thankfully, we had money in the same
that
we can use. So.
I think we get it. I mean, I'm not concerned about it. I just think we could probably do a better job.
Yeah, and definitely we need to check the accounting, like right before it gets adopted, the new budget gets adopted. Make sure that all the numbers still make sense.
It's a function of the change of leadership down in that department.
Actually, it's a function when they're in Monaco.
Huh?
It's that's close enough.
Yeah. I mean, we understand what the problem is. Next year, we won't have that problem.
Lessons learned.
Hopefully.
Honestly, that's my first time that it has been that way.
Because we know exactly how many miles we're going to overlay or chip seal every year.
Right, and you know we can account for an increase of 2-3%, and you know we usually have a buffer as well with the quantities, so we're usually right on. But this I didn't account for.
I think if you know the number, I don't see any reason accounting should ever just totally change that number.
That was my argument. Ray's going to bring that up next.
Yeah, I support you in that. Yeah. That's ridiculous.
And we're still the beneficiary of low oil prices.
Yeah, although the prices were going best cheap. So when we're talking about asphalt, it went a little higher this year. So,
but I mean, compared to 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just going to be a guess every single year. I mean, when you budget for the upcoming year, you can only guess at what oil prices are going to be. Mm-hmm. You ready for an
emotion? I'm ready.
All right.
You want to just buy everything today?
Hey, it's your signature. No,
sounds good. Go for it.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve and authorize your signature on the Notice of Award and Associated Contract Documents and authorize the County Manager to electronically sign the purchase order for the 2019 Chip Seal Project GMCO LLC in an amount not to exceed $447,583.30.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Last one.
Okay. We're here for the IFB 643 Overlay 2019 project, and we'd like the consideration by the Board of County Commissioners for approval and authorization of the Chair to sign the Notice of Award and Associated Contract Documents to Elam Construction, Inc., Incorporated for a not to exceed amount of $895,716 for the 2019 overlay applications. This was originally funded at $850,000 spread over the various roads, as they're noted. And we are also taking we're taking $45,000 out of the remaining $111,000 plus in the leveling account.
Got it.
So we went out for a bid from our two known suppliers. Both suppliers responded, and the results were close, about $100,000 off. So we went with the low bid of $895,716 from Elam, and we meet our policies and procedures and our budget.
Same thing, this is our yearly overlay for, you know, our 20-year rotation. The roads are stated on the front of the page, communication, they're getting overlay treatment this year. We have worked with Elam Construction in the past for the last 4 years, I believe, or 5 years. And they do great work. And I really enjoy working with them. They communicate well. The only thing that stops overlay is weather. So But it's they do really good work.
I don't have any questions. Do you have some questions, Tim?
Yeah, just a second. Give me a minute.
Okay.
Almost there.
Okay.
A pregnant pause, as they say.
So, the suspense.
30,000 lineal feet is what I come up with on the, including the bid alternates.
We are not doing the bid alternates at 850,000.
At 895?
Oh, 895,000.
We're not doing the three bid alternates.
No.
So we're doing 28,655 feet divided by 5,280. We're doing 5.4 miles. And what's the total amount?
895,716.
Roughly 895,000 divided by, what did I say? 4.2? 5.2 divided by 5.2. $172,000 a mile. So, yeah, I've always said in my head $175,000 a mile is typically what it's cost us to do overlays.
Yeah.
That's been a round number then, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
It's 170. And that includes some leveling. Not very much, because you are doing some.
We're doing 2-inch overlay on this. So usually the level.
Oh, you're not doing any level.
There's no level.
No level on this.
You're okay.
Yeah.
You're using some.
So it also depends on the width of the road.
Right. It's a rough number.
Right.
So okay. Well, now that I know that, I'm ready to make a motion.
Great.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve and authorize your signature on the notice of award and associated contract documents and authorize the county manager to electronically sign the purchase order to Elam Construction, Inc. for a not-to-exceed amount of $895,716 for 2019 overlay applications.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Nicely done. Right on time.
Got it. Thanks. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. There's a lot of you, so maybe we can just start with introductions. I'm Beth Melton, Commissioner.
Tim Carrigan, Commissioner.
Stephanie Einfeld, Northwest Colorado Health, CEO.
Kelly Keith, Rob County Human Services Director.
Jacob Perry, Prevention Strategies Manager with Northwest Colorado Health.
Carrie Lajo, Northwest Colorado Health.
Ferris Milanich, Northwest Colorado Health.
Amy Knights, Northwest Colorado Health.
Erin Dane, Northwest Colorado Health.
Heather Savalots, Rock County Environmental
Health. Scott Kelman, Rock County Environmental Health.
Dan Weinheimer, Rock County.
Tom Sullivan, County Manager.
Do you want
it?
Hi, Jim. Come on, we have a chair.
Yeah, put me next night. Watch out. You should get
everything Kelly and I
want. Jim Johnson, Emergency Preparedness and Response, Regional Staff, including Rock County specifically.
Great. Thank you. I don't know who's kicking us off. Scott, are you? Is it someone else who's presenting here?
I think that usually Carrie presents, and so I will just hand it right off to you. There's been a presentation prepared and an agenda, and I would say take it away. Thanks.
Hey, great. Thanks for having us. We thought we would take this opportunity to do some education about the return on investment for public health. We've talked about it the last couple of meetings, but thought we'd put some formality around it and share some data. And so I'll do just a brief overview, and then each manager is going to present their ROI data for their programs. So this is a statistic that I think you've seen in the past before, but I just wanted to reiterate about public health and the medical care expenditures that the U.S. is spending right now. Break down to more than $8,000 for each man, woman, and child, or about $2.6 trillion in 2015. And I just wanted to highlight that we are, as the United States, not on the top 20 for the recent ranking of the healthiest countries. And it just causes the conversation of, what can we do differently as a country in order to compete with the health of other countries? They obviously have some things in place that are helping them to succeed with their health outcomes, and we can take a look at that and reflect on it for our own country. A 2017 review of international studies found that the ROI on public health is $14.30 per dollar invested, and that every dollar that's spent on early childhood health and development saves up to $9 in future spending on health, social, and justice services. So the return on investment is 800%. For the long-term outcomes of the population, chronic disease is one of the areas where the ROI really shines. And chronic disease is one of the leading causes of death and disability in the United States. And the leading causes of chronic disease are tobacco use, physical inactivity and exposure, and as well as poor nutrition. And I think that that really highlights why the return on investment for public health programs is really important. Here's a chart that demonstrates the ROI. And what I liked about this is that it breaks it down by individual intervention sources. So just to look at, you can read this obviously yourself, but the child safety seat ROI is 3,900%. The CPHA and APHA has cited that, as well as water fluoridation, mental health, and addiction as some of the top ROI for public health. But then as you see down the list, there really is an ROI for public health. And so that translates not only to a return on investment, but obviously these are people's lives that we're talking about here and them being significantly impacted by public health interventions. So just to conceptualize what $10 of public health spending can buy, these are just a few statistics that I thought were interesting. There can be a decrease of 7.4% in infectious disease morbidity, and Farrell will talk more about that as far as the immunizations and the communicable diseases. And then salmonella, a decrease of 0.4 cases per 10,000 persons, and then a decrease of 3.3% to 6% of county-level STD rates, and that's just for a $10 spending rate. So if you imagine, if you multiply the spending for public health, these outcomes obviously impact more people's lives. Just for interest, I thought you might be interested in what the five most costly and preventable chronic conditions are in the United States and the cost to the United States as well. And the cost is $347 billion, which is 30% of total health spending for those chronic conditions. Mm-hmm. Those five medical conditions are heart conditions, cancer, trauma-related disorders, mental disorders, and COPD and asthma. And that's just between the span of 2002 to 2012. And Jacob later, when he talks about the CHAPS data and kind of our county-specific data, I'll break that down even more. Jacob is the Prevention Strategies Manager. You've met him before. He's presented about CHAPS. But as far as prevention strategies, he's going to talk to us a little bit about the ROI for these prevention strategies programs that we have in place.
Yeah. So we'll start off with CHAPS, which is a community health assessment planning system. And the PHIP is the Public Health Improvement Plan. Just for anyone who's not familiar with some of the acronyms, we're very acronym heavy in public health and in healthcare in general. So CHAPS is one of those that's it's really tough to quantify an ROI just because public health improvement plan are their strategies. They vary from community to community, and also how an individual or community implements a strategy could be different as well. But the things that a CHAPS process and the public health improvement plan does, it really helps with the community to set their health priorities, focus on what the resources are on those priorities. And on a previous slide that Carrie showed, popping back to the ROI with all the percentages. Some of these, for example, We had talked previously about our two main categories around physical safety and mental health. And just for an example, if we're talking about unintentional injuries and motor vehicle injuries, child safety seat program, as you can see, has a very good return on investment. When we're talking about mental health addiction, you can see that it's 3,600% ROI. Tobacco and tobacco cessation, food and nutritional, these are all components or could be strategies within the public health improvement plan. So it's difficult to quantify the public health improvement plan as a whole, but I wanted to show some examples of some particular or potential strategies. The CHAPS process helps provide facts of which we as organizations that participate can make programmatic and organizational decisions. It helps ourselves and our partners plan effectively and working together to provide interventions rather than just one single organization doing it alone. It also increases the ability for organizations to secure funding. And in some ways, we talked before about how we're writing the public health improvement plan to allow larger agencies who work regionally to write grants using this plan, as well as smaller groups who are county-specific can still use this plan to address either show, here are some strategies that we're doing and we need to secure funding for, or using data within that public health improvement plan. And then the last piece around supporting advocacy for policy changes. We know that a lot of our work is more of an intervention in some ways, and there are varying degrees of prevention. And the further upstream we can go, the more broad reach our strategies have. So not just focusing on a specific population or subpopulation, you can focus on some of these changes community-wide. Tobacco outreach and education is another program that we have done. We've just kind of picked it up again this year. For every dollar invested in tobacco prevention programs, saves up to $20 in future healthcare costs. And when we're getting into specific strategies, one of the main ones is point of sale. So Steamboat currently has a non-cigarette tobacco retail license, and that is what's considered a point of sale strategy. It's fairly new. It hasn't been fully studied as far as its impact as far as a return on investment. But with those efforts, you can see a decrease of tobacco sales to minors by an average of 33.5%, and also cut usage of tobacco by minors by about 6% or so. So while it doesn't have a dollar amount, there are reductions in use and initiation among youth.
Will you explain what that means?
Sure. For
just the non-tobacco license?
Yeah. Sure, totally. So prior to this year, there's a House Bill 1033. Prior to this year, municipalities could implement a retail licensing system of which it had to be non-cigarette tobacco. There was a lot of tax dollars tied into retail licensing. So if a municipality imposed a sales tax on tobacco products, or did, I believe, also age increases, or a cigarette or tobacco retail licensing that included cigarettes, they would lose, I believe, the 27% of tax dollars that come back to the municipality. So In Control was a way that municipalities could have groups that sell tobacco products register or have a license to sell those products. There would also be a almost like the Safe Serve or the liquor compliance,
like tips.
It was a similar concept to that, or it is a similar concept to that, where you're taxing or you're licensing the sale of snuff, chew, vape products, anything that isn't a cigarette. But a lot of times you get cigarette retailers because they sell a lot of those products. So it was a way around the law that allowed municipalities to, one, fund enforcement of compliance and allow that to happen more often than what the state could provide.
Thank you.
Yeah. And lastly, communities that care is for every dollar spent, CTC sees an ROI of $5.31 in the form of lower criminal justice system, crime victims, healthcare costs, and also increased earnings and tax revenue as well. And CTC, this is from the head CTC group out of the University of Washington, and this has been a program that's been studied extensively over the last 10 years across multiple states and communities.
What is that money spent on? So when you say CTC dollars, what does money invested in CTC mean?
Sure. It varies. So the traditional model of CTC focused primarily on programs. So it basically you engage a broad sector of community focused on youth substance use, lowering risk factors such as low neighborhood attachment, delinquency, commitment to school, opportunities for pro-social moments, or like activities for kids to do that involve groups rather than being alone. And the traditional model funds programs more so. So one example could be an after-school program that Boys and Girls run, Boys and Girls Club. Here in Colorado, they're funding what's called strategies, so they're higher-level community-wide initiatives. And, for example, Grand County is looking at laws and norms favorable to substance use and perception of harm among students. So kids see the use of certain products not as harmful as other areas of the state. In Rapid County, our risk factors are focused on laws and norms favorable to substance use, as well as youth and parental attitudes favorable to substance use. So strategy-wise, you would be looking at addressing laws and norms or perceptions of or that favorable perception across the community itself.
Farah is our public health nurse manager, and she's going to talk to us a little bit. This is Farah, and she's our public health nurse manager, and she's going to talk about childhood immunization rates.
So there was a study done at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and they studied the return on investment for vaccinations, and they found that every dollar invested in vaccines was estimated to result in a return of 16 times the cost. And when considering broader economic and social benefits, the return on investment for immunizations was 44 times the vaccine cost itself. Some of their key findings were that vaccines obviously are an excellent investment, which is in line with other studies in which immunizations were listed among other development investments as having one of the best values for the money. And if we, you know, return back to the other slide that Carrie had all the ROIs listed, I think it was at 1,500% ROI for vaccines. Net benefits exceeded costs across all 10 of the antigens during the decade that they studied. And the return on investment obviously depends heavily on the ability to raise financial investments necessary to achieve the coverage rates. So continued funding from government and things like that to help the immunization rates.
I do not.
Okay, Amy?
Actually, this is Erin's.
Sorry.
We didn't sit in right
you
order.
So I'm the Women and Family Services Manager at Northwest Colorado Health, and the Nurse Family Partnership Program has been heavily studied. Dr. Olds is actually still following his very initial trials from 1977, and they're calculating the return on investment of this program for actually the third generations for some families. Most current research shows that more than $18,000 over and above program costs for each family is returned, and these savings accrue to government from decreased spending on health care and health protection.
prevention, education, criminal justice, and public assistance. And again, I mean, there's lots and lots of research around this program, so it's really neat to see as they come out. But and then the WIC program, so it's a nutrition education and breastfeeding support and supplemental food program that improves birth outcomes and reduces healthcare costs. And they don't have any super long-term studies with WIC. I think it's such a huge program, and then to follow for pregnancy and birth up in such a program, they haven't. But what they have done is study that it found that for every dollar on prenatal WIC participation, so spent on mom's participation during the program, results in a range of $1.77 to $3.13 in Medicaid costs in those first 60 days after birth, so on those improved birth outcomes. And then the Safe Care program, we just launched Safe Care here in Rock County about a year ago. And it's the most recent research was 2017, and it returns $20.25 in cost savings for every dollar spent on training and implementation of the program. So and those, again, are a result of keeping children out of child protective services and improving their quality of life.
Do you have any
questions for Aaron?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was waiting till everybody was done.
Oh, yeah. No, you're fine. Amy is the community health manager, and so she's going to talk to us about a couple different programs.
The two programs that I supervised, and some of the other ones, I couldn't find any return on investment. But the Colorado Heart Healthy Solutions, is found to reduce costs and increase quality of life by cardiovascular events. This study was actually done in, 2014, and this was done from the Colorado School of Public Health. And it shows that, on the average, the males, average 52 years old, will save like $9.39, and the average female is $4.96 for every dollar spent. Now, an at-risk male, you can see there's higher cost savings, and at-risk females. And those are the ones that, are overweight, inactive, smoke, have family history of, heart disease and stuff. Those are considered the at-risk females and males. The other program that I found return on investment on was a baby and me tobacco-free. And for infants and mothers enrolled in the program had a 14% lower risk of low birth weight and a 24% lower risk of preterm birth. So every dollar invested there was the $6.73 savings. So that's a good program. And that one's just within Colorado. Both of these are through the state. They're studied through the state.
Some of the challenges that you face when you're trying to look at the return on investment for public health is just that public health generally takes action before someone's sick, so people who have avoided that illness are not identifiable, and so then it's hard to quantify. So that 5-10 year prevention approach is hard to quantify in a quantified sense. And the benefits from it are often realized long-term, so years, decades, a long time from now, right? So that's some of the challenges that even with us, when we were trying to quantify the return on investment, we found in trying to collect data for our programs. I mean, I think one example is with WIC. Aaron, and when you're out in the community, everybody knows what WIC is. It's a valued program. People are really attached to the WIC program. They have personal stories about it. But then when you try to find the data to support it, it's harder to come up with that, even though it is a well-respected program. So. And then additionally, populations can differ in their priorities and their principles, so there can be some disagreement on what the merits of each program is itself. We've even talked through that all collectively about some of the programs we offer. Some people see value in them, some people don't. There's just differences in perception on what the ROI is and what the ROI for another program. So where do you make your investments? So those are some of the challenges. That's our ROI part of our presentation.
Do you have questions?
I do.
Go ahead.
I guess a comment would be, I mean, the return on investment discussion is a good one. Sometimes it's depressing when we're taking human health, and we feel like we're required to boil it down into dollars and cents. I think, you know, using public dollars, we kind of need to be able to justify that we're spending money. It would be interesting to see if you really sort of return on investment to its logical conclusion, what's the payback period? So let's just say, for instance, that Brown County decided to start spending an additional $500,000 a year on public health. When do we get our money back? That's probably too much of a mathematical exercise to go through, but that would be an interesting thing. What are some specific things, and you alluded to this, that other countries are doing that we're not? You know, we're spending twice as much money. We're 20th or below in the health rankings. Wouldn't it be simple enough? Well, let's just, you know, we've got some models out there. Let's look at countries that are doing it right. Is there a clean, easy path to do that? No.
I don't know that there's a golden ticket to any of it, but I think early childhood investments in early childhood wellness is one thing that comes to the forefront. Prenatal care, I think, is a big, a common theme throughout those countries. And then also sort of the wellness model of taking care of the citizens and taking care of the employees and investing in health all the way along, whether it's through the employer or through the community itself, really making that investment, I think, are common themes amongst what I saw with other countries. Interestingly, and this is just a side note, but I grew up overseas, and so in Germany, which was where I primarily grew up, I saw a whole different model, and so it's interesting to see just the differences between the countries and how healthcare needs are proactively handled, and then the preventative side of it through the different models. So I think it's definitely something to take into consideration, because we have other successful models out there for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I can answer my own question. A lot of this is cultural rather than programmatic. So I don't know that we can pay into a whole bunch of programs. Doesn't mean we're going to end up with a different culture. It is what it is at a certain point. Jim, there's no return on investment for the work that you do?
No, you get me. How's that for swagger? You know, when I did some research for this, and I looked at a lot of different sites, including CDC and other countries and other states, we found that most of the information was specific to healthcare or hospitals. Four walls, it's really great to be able to determine what your cost for an aspirin is, but it's really hard beyond those four walls. So there hasn't been a lot of research done in terms of what is the ROI for emergency preparedness and response. What I did, Jim, was I actually gave a couple copies to Tom and to Dan about major accomplishments in Round County in my position. That was easier for me to at least signal down with bullet points to tell you what and where we're at. I actually have a couple extra copies for going back to my video. And that basically just goes through. I do this for all four counties in my region, so I present quite often in front of Jackson or Rio Blanco or Moffitt also. And a lot of it is relationship building. When something does happen, who do you call, who can order the right stuff, and so on. So I've been working with Mo for quite a long time, and Bob before that, and Chuck Vale before that. Okay, so a lot of that is part of it, and it's really hard to put a dollar value on. One of the accomplishments here was to do outreach with the Spanish-only speaking population, undocumented, illegal, whatever. You know, that's not my forte, but we actually had over 60 people sign up for Everbridge for reverse 911 from that outreach. So those are all folks, vast majority are living along the river in mobile home parks. So now we have an ability to contact and outreach to those folks in multiple languages, that if there was a flood situation on the AMPA, we can get them out of there. So what is the cost of them possibly losing their property, possibly losing a life, versus getting them into a shelter? It's a really hard figure to, you know, pick down. So anyway, that's kind of a nutshell why I didn't have a slide up here, is we just don't have good information.
Part of the reason that I picked on you, as you may recall, some years ago. You and I worked closely together in the school security task force, and through the years, my thinking on this has evolved somewhat, and I think that I've become a little bit frustrated how much money we spend on hardening our schools,
yes,
protecting against what is really a statistically improbable event, a school shooting. And I know it's a pretty emotional thing. Nobody likes to talk about not doing everything we can to protect our children in schools. But there was a really interesting article in the Colorado Sun just a few days ago about how much money we spend on school security in the state, $35 million, approximate number, and we spend about $11 million on mental health services in the schools. And,
yep.
I mean, if we're really serious about numbers and public health, it really feels like we ought to split those numbers upside down. It just feels wrong to me. But I'm not sure that this group can take on that responsibility.
Remember when we were on that task force, we were always talking about prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Now my job, along with my 13 counterparts around the state, we basically go around the schools, not from a strategic or law enforcement point of view, but how to survive the event.
I recall that. I mean, even back then, we talked about the fact that our ability to actually prevent a school shooting was very small, and what we needed to do was focus on what we did when it happened, which was also
But you're right, the mental health piece is just not been touched on at all, on so many levels.
I've got one more question and then one comment. The CHAPS program, where are we at on that assessment?
He has a whole presentation
that's
prepared.
That's part two.
And then while I've got this group together and just need to put in the plug, we've formed a complete count census committee. We started having our kickoff meeting last week, and I think that there's a number of you in this room, or at least we'd like to see at least one representative from Northwest Colorado Health.
I was out of town. Okay.
Real important one, especially when we talk about bringing more funding into the community. This is something we can actually do to get that done. So I'm done. Thank you.
Thanks. I don't have any other questions. I already asked my. If I want to circle back just to the CTC, you mentioned that. I guess I'm curious whether the data is there to support the model that Colorado is using, because you mentioned that historically it's been these more programmatic things, and I can picture how that would really prevent. And I think I haven't attended these meetings, but my illustrious counselor here has indicated that it doesn't always feel like it's going somewhere. And so I guess just the question of, would we predict these same outcomes, and what's the research on that?
So, strategy-wise, there isn't too much. The whole state of Colorado, a lot of the CDPHE funding is moving towards an upstream funding, in the sense of you're looking at community-wide strategies. One issue with programmatic is you're focusing on a very specific population, sometimes an at-risk population or a high-risk population, so your impact of your program is a lot smaller than it would be if it was a broader group. So just in purely speculating, if we're thinking a broad school system-wide implementation of a strategy, you would hit those at-risk, those potentially at-risk individuals and the high-risk. So you would have a bigger impact than you would with a very specific program. It's going to take a little bit of time to actually quantify any dollar amounts. It is new for Colorado. However, the structure of it and the process of it is the same, and we're also using what's called the Community Toolbox, which some of you may be familiar with. They outline a lot of ways of engaging community and involving a broader group, and then the state has some best practices strategies with evidence of what's entailed in that strategy and why it works and what specifically it impacts.
Yeah, that's a thoroughly unsatisfying answer, but that's
okay. Yeah.
It's all good. I'm not shaking my head. It's fine. I guess this is not a criticism of you. It's just a sort of broader question around strategy and what works. Because when I picture like an after-school program where you're providing direct services to kids and keeping them out of trouble versus I'm going to try to convince their parents that they shouldn't think drinking is okay, like that's a big – there's a big difference there in how impactful I think you could expect to be.
Yeah. So there are it's a wide range of strategies. Yeah. One in particular, and one that we're looking at in Moffitt County, is Safe Spaces for Youth. And it has very specific after-school program, tutoring, activities, very similar to what Boys and Girls Club offers, but the ability to expand that and have a larger space. And so there's a group exploring that option with Boys and Girls Club as well. So there are actual tangible and programmatic pieces that go into that. It's just kind of on a broader scale. A lot of the strategies, the way they're worded, are like social and emotional learning curriculum. I mean, in a way that's a program, but if you implement it on a district-wide or a broader scale than just one specific grade, then it does become a strategy.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Would you all like to transition to your second part of your...
Sure, but I did let them know that these managers...
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Thanks.
See you guys.
Here,
see you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Well, so I believe the last time we met, wanted to go through kind of an update of what the 2012-2016 public health improvement plan, what it was, and some of the outcomes, as well as some of the data and information that we covered up until fairly recently. So I guess it's the first half of the data and potential priorities conversation. So we'll go ahead and jump in. Just kind of at the time of this presentation, in the initial discussion of data, we were within these phases, so you could do a lot of different phases at the same time. So we collected data and interpreted data. We looked at, could we discuss capacity? Currently we're in five and going into six in the prioritization of issues. We recently are getting some of the community health needs assessment survey data back. The partnership is working with Colorado Health Institute to look through and analyze the data, as well as get some breakdowns countywide and community-wide information. So it's not just this is what the region said, but you know, we had this many responses in Steamboat, Craig, and Oak Creek, and other areas within our community, and try to get what maybe if there were little nuances or differences in priorities depending on area. So that's where we are phase-wise. We're right within this phase five, this end of this month, early May, we'll be moving into finalizing the prioritization of issues. We'll present those to you all for consideration, and then in June, write that public health improvement plan and deliver as well, which I'm getting ahead of myself for next steps. So here are some of the goals within the 2012 to the 2016. Goal one was reduce the rate of unintended pregnancy in Northwest Colorado, specifically in Route and Moffitt counties. The strategy was seek funding for long-acting contraceptives and also a social marketing campaign in Route and Moffitt counties. Goal two was increasing the awareness of unintentional injuries through a media campaign. Goal three was focused on mental health, specifically in reducing barriers to treatment created by social stigmas increase the awareness of mental health issues and reduce suicide rates in Route and Moffat counties. The primary strategy within that was screening of individuals and then referral to necessary resources. And then the final goal was within environmental health, was obtaining equipment and operational funding for monitoring of PM10 and PM2.5, provide public access to those results via the Route County website, continue surface and implement a new groundwater quality monitoring program with stakeholders, and then provide data and trends, trend reports to public health, or excuse me, to the public via website and public meeting. So this next one is, at least it's big enough and we can read it. These are, on the left, are the strategies with the goals that we had, and within those, that 2006 to 2010 for EC for unintended pregnancy, that was the measure that we used within the 2012 to 2016 plan, and the goal was a 10% reduction in unintended pregnancy. The source of this is a national survey. It's I think it's Pregnancy Risk and Monitoring System. So it's similar to the Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, which some of you may be familiar with. It is a survey given to women who after pregnancy. So they're not surveyed when they go into their doctor. They're not surveyed while giving birth. They're surveyed a period of time afterwards. And like some of our areas, there are suppressed data, or there's not enough surveys, there's not enough respondents, or in some cases, maybe a sampling wasn't chosen because there weren't enough births in that area. So you can see for the unintended pregnancy within Route County, the time period is 2011 to 2014. When we pulled this information in 2016, 2015 wasn't available, so we used whatever what was a bit what we had. And I also do have a slide a little bit later on that shows a more current, including 2015. But as you can see, there was an increase in what was the unintended pregnancy rate. At that time, there we did do our marketing and some media as well. But you know, at the time, there wasn't any funding available, or funding didn't really fit a model. There is Choose When, which started, I believe, in 2016-17. So it is available within Route County, and I believe they've extended it to Moffat and Rio Blanco as well. And most of the data is showing that a program that allows women access to long-acting reversible contraceptives does show a decrease within the unintended pregnancy rate. However, that time frame is about 10 years. So we've got a long while before some of this data may show a decrease. For unintentional injury, again, this is one that we looked at funding, but either there was no funding source or funding for a program. However, we did use or do a campaign on helmet usage, ATV safety, fireworks safety, and seatbelt usage in 2014. And I'll show some data on the actual numbers that we're seeing currently. For mental health, as I mentioned, there was a screening and referral piece. We did meet those goals of 80% of patients seen are screened. We actually did very well with a 97.8% screening rate of patients that we saw. And if anyone said that were identified as positive, so that could be that, you know, they said they had depression or high stress or anxiety, or tested positive for an issue with their mental health, they were then referred at a 96.5% rate. So those that were screened were referred if they were positive. So we actually did really well within those goals. We also did social media and marketing as well, and we do that on many different topics. We actually still do that consistently throughout our social media, local advertising, print media as well, and you know, during any during Mental Health Awareness Month and any other days of health observance relating to mental health. And then for environmental health was air and water quality, compliance with national standards, currently in compliance, obtaining the air monitoring equipment, and it is purchased and on the top of the building. And then establish and maintain the monitoring program, and there is an agreement between Rapid County and the United States Geological Service, and then there is public access to the water quality data through the Colorado Data Sharing Network.
Did you have anything you wanted to add on?
Yeah, I was thinking we should talk because I think that we can update that stuff a little bit. You know, the data is best observed or consumed, you know, through the USGS website. We don't have to have this conversation now. But we can update you on what's going on with the PM 2.5 monitors. And, so, you know, all the elements are there, but I think that we should just have a chat and talk about updating those things. And I guess the other question I had was, you know, we've had those PM10 monitors up on top of the building since 1990. And so, you know, we're meeting, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, I guess we're meeting our requirements. And I did talk to the Air Pollution Control Division about, you know, how long do we have to do this? We've shown that we've been in compliance for 20 years. And they gave me a pretty good explanation about what that process is. But eventually we will look at taking those down if we're still meeting all those requirements. But we're still in a phase, believe it or not, where we're in an evaluation period and meeting, you know, requirements for the amount of time those are running and that we're meeting those limitations.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we could update that a little bit.
Any questions, comments on the 2012-2016 public health improvement plan? Or?
Surprisingly, yes. Do you want to go first this time?
Sure. I can go first this time. I think the last time we talked about the CHAPS process, I still feel a little lost on, we do it for 5 years, you know, every 5 years or whatever, and then what happens? And I think even after looking at this, I still have that question because I see that of the 4 identified goals, 2, we didn't have enough funding to really do anything. And then it seems like there was a lot of advertising, marketing, and I guess I just am curious, and this is maybe just a question, not trying to, that you wouldn't necessarily answer right this minute, but, you know, what's the impact of going through this process, and if this is kind of what we get out of it, I guess I just still feel a little lost on what it is we're really doing and are we improving the health of our local population through this process? Because I imagine it's a lot of money and time spent going through this process to say, well, we came up with some really good strategies and then we can fund them. So let's do this again in 5 years.
And I would add on to that, in that I think that in order to go through the process and do a thorough evaluation and get good results also takes time and resources. So I would ask also, do we feel like we've put forth the time and resources necessary to get something that's going to be useful?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess that's sort of more of a comment. I don't know if there's a response that any of you might make to that.
We do have a timeline. Do you want to talk a little bit about the clarification on the timeline since the timing got a little bit off? And so we did reach out to find out sort of, are we going to be starting this process over again or how does that look?
I would just say, like, that's a really good learning point and a learning curve. Like, this is we're just finishing the second iteration.
Iteration. Yeah, thanks for that reminder.
Like, that's a really good learning point to take forward as we decide on where to focus, like making sure, like, okay, do we have the community budget for this? Do we have support for this? Is this actually feasible?
or not, and what are the tangible outcomes or expectations that we expect to get out of it.
Yeah, that's helpful. I sort of forgot that this was like the first time around, basically. So.
Yeah. No, and that, I mean, that's a great point. I think that's a lot of communities are learning that process, maybe some bit off more than they could chew the first go around, and maybe tailoring it down a little more. Or others might realize, hey, we can bring in more individuals into this process to cover a broader group of a broader area of the community, and also additional funding, so it doesn't fall on one agency to provide that funding or seek that funding. And you'll see in some of my subsequent slides that some of these continue to pop up and may be priority areas within the next community, public health improvement plan. And some of them are outlined a little more specifically within the community health needs assessment, especially around when we're talking about mental health. That's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, I think inherently I understand and appreciate the importance of public health, and I think kind of, and maybe this is more criticism of what we're being asked to do than the way we're doing it. Like, this just probably illustrates the criticism of where we don't, like, what's actually being accomplished, you know, through this process. I mean, I'd much rather see that we're, something is happening than we're talking about process all the time. Because I think about, like, the... you know, the past success in Colorado of providing LARCs to women, and I mean, they were huge. The numbers were amazing, and things like that, where you can really see the benefit on a community-wide basis, I mean, are compelling, right?
Yeah.
But saying we care about unintended pregnancy, but we didn't actually do anything about it, is kind of not very satisfying.
No, I understand.
So I'd like to... support Commissioner Melton's comments and really double down on them. And this is a criticism that I would have of a lot of different things that are called strategic plans, which is, I really feel like, and again, not to be overly critical, because I'm not saying you guys aren't doing what it is that you're supposed to be doing, but other than unintended pregnancies, when I look at the other three areas, they all revolve around, as Beth said, education and data gathering. And so looking at air and water, I feel like sometimes we're confusing methods with goals. So these are some good methods to engage in if your goal is to gather data. But under air and water, what our goal really should be is to reduce asthma, COPD, in some kind of measurable way. So, and that's the same, you know, for unintentional injury and mental health is, gosh, we're screening, we're gathering data, we're understanding the problem better, but it seems like we're not getting to the problem.
And I, you know, and I understand what you're saying. We talk about this USGS money every year, and, you know, we collect that data, and I told you, you know, it's kind of like buying insurance, that you're ready to respond to a problem. And then we've also, you know, this year used that data and are doing, you know, currently right now, that nutrient study is happening. They're using that data, and it's connecting directly to some health, potential health problems, you know, the toxic algae that we talked about. And we're seeing nutrients a little bit on the rise, and you know, we were seeing what happened in the White River with their algae problems. And then also with this PM2.5 monitoring, you know, I questioned the PM10, how long do we have to do that? I got an explanation. But with this PM2.5 data, you know, we're responding to concerns from school administrators and the public about wildfire smoke specifically. It seems like that PM2.5, it's one of the five criteria pollutants, but it also seems like it's where we have the most risk in this community. So along with collecting that data, we have a system where the public can go online and look at the data, and then we also have resources that connect to that to say, hey, if you're at this age and we have an air quality index of this, it might not be appropriate for you to go outside today. Or you should limit your activity if you have, you know, respiratory issues. So I think we are making those some of those connections. We're not capturing it there, and I'm just talking for environmental health. And so, but, you know, I agree. It's nice to see that data collection, those efforts, actually connecting to something that's tangible.
So if you could make some kind of a correlation between PM2.5 levels and expected incidence of asthma and COPD in your community, say, hey, if we can reduce this 2.5, then and then we can measure over a long period of time what our per capita cases of asthma and COPD are in the community, that's the goal. That should be what the goal is reducing these health negative health outcomes.
Right. Well, we're trying.
And that's the goal.
We're trying to prevent
this, and having this and reducing PM2.5 levels would help you achieve that goal. And before that is collecting the data to know where you're at today, so that you can measure where you're going in the future. That's a tall order. I get that's not easy work.
Right. And it's really geared towards prevention, so that people have that information, and so they aren't putting themselves at risk, and they're not having to go
to the hospital. So if we're successfully preventing, our return on investment, or one of our returns on investment, would be a reduction in the number of cases of these kinds of negative health outcomes.
And that's where we have a hard time quantifying that all the time.
I just have a small question. When you started talking about mental health, I was expecting you to talk about the mental health first aid program. So I guess I'm curious why that's not included. Mental health first aid, which was rolled out at a pretty large scale in this community over in this time period, yeah. Right?
I don't know. I personally don't know if it was available at the time of the public health improvement plan. I believe MindSprings Health handled that, and now currently the Health Partnership does.
Okay.
But that could be a component of a new plan.
Well, and isn't part of the purpose of the plan that you're capturing all the things that are going on, not just what you're doing?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. Okay.
So maybe the time frame is off. Came into play after this.
I'm not familiar with when that actually started, but I believe our agency and MindSprings Health were involved or listed on as those handling the strategy around mental health. It was just the screening and referral piece that maybe took more precedent because of either capacity or funding. I'm not too certain about that.
And I don't have history on that either.
So yeah, we collectively,
none of us don't have.
We weren't involved in there.
Well, I participated, so I
can. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah. It was great. I mean, it's awesome, and it has a lot of data behind it. I mean, I think you look at the data, like from New Zealand, I believe they saw a pretty significant impact population wide of implementing that program.
Well, this, you know, one of the intentions of the public health improvement plan is that you have partners from outside of just one organization that work on this collectively.
Right.
So I can't speak to that, but. When I saw the numbers of the screening, and I wondered if that was just our clinic or if that's for the whole population, because you're right, it should be the whole population. The goal should be the whole population, not one subset of the population. So I don't think, and again, I can't speak to the history of this, but.
Right. Well, I'll move into some data tables, and we can go through them pretty quickly. These were just ones that are specific to route. I include state, regional. But the first one is on injury. These are from the Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. And for falls, it's 2012 and 14. And for the adults who reported driving using a seatbelt while riding in a car is 2013 to 15. So you can see older adults, we have a higher fall rate within or percentage reporting a fall in the last 3 months in our older adult population, as well as slightly lower seatbelt usage of adults. And later I have some tables on statistics on morbidity or mortality of unintentional injuries.
Here I highlighted the percent of pregnancies resulting live births that were unintended. As you can see in Route County, 42.9%, and that time frame a little bit longer than the previous slide. So this is a potential for another priority or strategy within the Route County or even within other communities if there's good data.
Am I correct in saying that this means that 43% of pregnancies are unintended?
You and I just are just climbing right into the same things.
Is that really what that means?
So that's an interesting... So the survey itself only really talks about timing. Was it too early? Did it intend during that time?
Right.
There are other studies or other surveys, and there was a comparison of one in England that actually gets down into kind of the more detail of why the pregnancy was unintended or considered unintended. So you see some differences in rates there as well. So a lot of it is just, it's really, did you want this or was the timing wrong? So it's really... you may have wanted a child, but it might be just too early, so it's considered unintended. So the measure itself is interesting, and I was surprised when I saw the number as well and started actually reading into it a little more. However, I'm really interested in following the data for the Choose When program and see how that rate changes over time. But yeah, it was very interesting. Care and prevention, FAIR actually hit on some of these pieces before within the chronic disease or the immunizations piece. The first column is really percent of women who said they received adequate prenatal care. And I found this one very interesting and how significantly lower that is than the state. And trying to do some more digging into what goes into that and what were they considering adequate.
What years is this from?
So that is from Risk Factor Surveillance 2013-15. So
yeah, you might dig into the uninsured rate as a correlation.
Definitely. And then I also highlighted some of the immunization rates related to flu shots and pneumonia shots. As you can see within each of our charts, Route County is the dark blue column, and it is lower than the state and within the region. And some of that is due to Colorado's exemptions, have the easiest exemption for immunizations, and some of it could just be due to timing, or just at that time maybe the flu shot, I believe, was in that time, was in this weird phase of how effective it is. So
I've never even heard of a pneumonia shot.
I had one for the first time this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, is it recommended for
my doctor recommend
people? I mean, because I see he recommended it enough, but
he recommended it to me.
Okay.
Because of my age.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, FAIR would definitely be able to explain more. Usually for immunizations that are in an older population, it's high risk. So if they already are immunocompromised or at risk, they may.
It's a really depressing juxtaposition of statistics looking at the one on the far right-hand side. So here we are with people over the age of 65. We're doing a really good job. 70% we're getting taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And women that are getting prenatal care, we're down around 40%. I mean, what is wrong with that picture? Yeah. I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah. And so these could be some priorities that we're discussing as well. I included the eligible but not enrolled. And at the time of this slide, this was from Colorado Health Institute's 2014 data. They are slowly releasing 2016 and 17. They're kind of slow. But one thing that I thought was interesting, if we're looking within Route County, percent of working adults aged 19 to 64 eligible but not enrolled in Medicaid, at 2014 it was 4.4, in 2015 it was 16.2, and then when you look at eligible but not enrolled for children in PHP plus, we're looking at 26.2%. So that's always, we always try to look at the eligible but not enrolled and see how we can engage those individuals.
How in the world does that happen? You get, Kelly, you've got people coming in that are applying for Medicaid, and we're signing them up, but we're not getting the children?
We actually both do.
I think the CHP plus one is hard because I don't think a lot of people that qualify for CHP plus can make, you know, 40,000, 50,000. Like, I'm doing good. I don't need to get my kid on CHP plus. And so I think that's a hard one. But it's the same thing with our SNAP numbers. It's I think it's more of an awareness thing than when people come in, we make sure they get connected to everything. It's just how do we reach out to everybody and tell that, and then they don't give any money in our allocations for outreach. So
that's what I was gonna say. 2014, the Affordable Care Act came online, right?
Yeah.
And the state put a substantial amount of money around outreach and enrollment. So like we had an outreach specific person and then three enrollment people.
So
you guys probably had the same. So like our outreach person was at the ski area getting the people that came into town and getting all these different people, and now they've whittled funding down to one person and right. There's just not the bandwidth. So there's multiple reasons for the Medicaid, like, eligible but not enrolled going up. I mean, part of it is people aren't wanting to take government benefits right now. There's that whole population. There's public charge. People are just worried about getting any sort of government assistance whatsoever. The state changed the rules of how people stay on Medicaid. So where they used to do a quarterly check, now people roll on and off every month. And so they may think they have Medicaid and they go to the doctor and they don't have Medicaid. So there's a lot behind right now. But I actually was just at a presentation with the director of HCPF, who's healthcare policy finance for the state, and that's one of their priorities right now is figuring out that Medicaid churn and figuring out how we can affect it. Because this is not the eligibility of Medicaid or uninsured going up is not unique to our this county. It's all over the state.
I probably have to try to get out of here by 3:15. So
okay.
If we can.
Yeah, I'll push through. Don't worry. The mental health ones, it's very tough to get data for our region, like county specific for mental health. These were three that that really jumped out. Percent of women who experienced one or more major life stress events.
Yeah, they got pregnant.
Yeah. I don't know that question. I don't know if they excluded that or what. But then also, and this is from a risk factor surveillance survey 2013-15 as well. Percent of women who drank alcohol during the last 3 months of pregnancy. Now, the specifics of the question, I don't know if it was one drink or multiple. Sometimes the descriptor isn't the best.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about this because some doctors will tell you you can drink during your last 3 months of pregnancy.
Yeah. That's the attitude of our physicians because I was told the exact same thing.
Yeah.
You can drink. You can have a glass of wine every night in your trimester, no problem.
Yeah.
So I think it's odd that it's being measured specifically during the last 3 months in this question.
Yeah. And these were really of what was available within the risk factor surveillance from CDPHE that jumped out. However, from the health needs assessment, substance use treatment, access, so we're looking at number of providers, wait times, multilingual access to behavioral health services. Those are some pieces that came out from the needs assessment that aren't really specifically measured within these pieces here. Looking at substance use, these are more for tobacco. For me, what I really are looking at is the Healthy Kids numbers for 2017, looking at youth vaping rates. 32.5% of high schoolers using a vape device in the last 30 days. Perceptions of harm are lower than what was considered for what they see for cigarettes, which is very interesting because in 2011, we had issues with smokeless tobacco, and a very similar percentage of high school students used that, and a very similar percentage of high school students said, it's not as harmful as cigarettes.
Isn't that a true statement?
No. There's been no, for vaping, it's not considered a healthy alternative,
I thought it was far less likely to cause cancer.
No.
Not true.
I don't think so, and I also think it's so new that there's not that long, those long-term studies to go either way.
But I mean, it's true that the vaping doesn't contain a lot of those nasty tars and other... It's got nicotine, right?
Because there's like smoke inhalation going on,
yeah.
Right?
It has nicotine. It has nicotine. It also has similar chemicals that cigarettes have in it.
Oh, really?
It also, when you superheat... the oils, it can cause diseases such as popcorn lung. It can also, you can superheat the metals and particulates go off. And so, yeah, there's still
Tim's
some
convinced.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah. I have that impression myself, so it's not surprising.
Yeah, no, and that's, what we're seeing, that's what we're seeing throughout the region with, you know, kids seeing it as more as a healthy alternative. Parents are saying, well, I thought this was a healthy alternative. You know, I don't know what, 5-10 years ago, you had e-cigarettes coming out as a cessation method, and it's really not a proven way of...
I'm just scared. The problem is that you can't prove that they're not right about that.
Well,
the presumption is that it's just as unhealthy.
It is.
But
yeah.
You, just like you said, we don't have the data. Right.
And you can do it anywhere, so it's probably worse.
But they are working on the data as well, and a lot of it, the major piece is that the nicotine component of it,
I believe
the effectiveness of it.
Carry on.
so I just want to, we did touch on the cigarettes and vapor products. Just kind of want to show the difference when you're talking about cigarettes versus when you're talking about vapor, and it's a very significant increase. Mm-hmm. And right now we have the regional data, but for Steamboat or Rouse County, it's pretty much straight on.
So I was confused by these graphs because the right-hand side says percentage, and
yes.
The question is, how old were you when you smoked a whole cigarette for the first time?
That's a great point. So this is the question that they were asking. They used a percentage of students that said they had ever used. So they didn't really look at if it was just 13 and older. They really just said, if you have ever said that you use this product, what a percentage of students said that.
So this is like the percentage of students that indicated a risk.
Yeah, and that's just how, yeah, unfortunately, Healthy Kids puts it out this way, and then you read the actual indicators and the what they were measuring with it, and then it gets into the percentage. It's very similar when we when you talk about perception of harm, and a lot of times that can be shown as a positive that, 70% of students say this is harmful, or on the inverse of that, 30% of the students find no harm in this product at all. Thank you for catching that. This one's a little bit harder because there's a lot of prescription drugs listed up here. And you can see these are in the past 30 days or during any time of your life. During your life, how many times have you taken a prescription pain medicine without a doctor's prescription or differently than how a doctor told you to use it? And these were drugs such as codeine, Vicodin, Oxycontin, hydrocodone, and Percocet. And so of high school seniors or high school students, almost 14% of them said that they, in their life, they have taken a prescription drug other than prescribed. And you can see it throughout in our region. It's slightly higher in some areas, but it's definitely something that individuals are talking about. We talk about substance use treatment and availability and the needs assessment, trying to drill down a little more on maybe what those specific substances are within each community to really tailor those strategies to fit that. And here we're looking at mortality data. I kept the motor vehicle accident hospitalizations in there just because it was something that we were looking at as well, and we were talking early about physical safety and that. And with rates, all of the rates are age-adjusted, and so what that really means is you take a crude rate, so your number of deaths divided by the total number of deaths, and adjust that to meet a population within, let's say, 5 to 14. So there's a standard population in that group. And then you can compare those rates with other communities a lot easier than just saying, well, we had 3 here and Denver had 15. So it's a way of comparing the two because when you look at our community, is really much smaller than the Denver area. So the top five for Rout County, all cancers was the number one leading cause of death within our community, followed by chronic lower respiratory disease, heart disease, then unintentional injuries and chronic lower respiratory disease. And suicide was one of the top five for our area. When you look at surrounding areas, originally this slide had all counties that in our area listed and just showing the top four, but suicide for Rout County was within the top five. It didn't show up on any other community's profile. So I just wanted to show those rates. Now we get into the fun pieces. I wanted to show, looked at incidence and mortality for 2011 to 2015. You know, it was in our paper recently talking about breast cancer incidence rates. And just kind of wanted to show a comparison between our counties our county and Colorado, just to kind of show that, you know, in some areas they are higher rates. For example, breast cancer is a significantly higher rate of incidence, so people diagnosed with this, than in the state of Colorado or in general. However, if we look at some of our mortality data, and I looked at it for the same time period just to be able to have a little bit of a comparison, and you can see that in some areas it's either suppressed, so there were very few deaths related to that cancer, or a lot of times these are happening in an older population. For example, like lung and bronchus is an older group that is typically dying from this. But I wanted to show this. It's kind of a, here's the diagnosis, and here is a...
you have some fun reading, don't you?
I do.
One thing I just wanted to say about this is there is sort of this, it's very personal in a small community when someone passes away from one of these or from suicide or whatever, and so it can become, you are suddenly alarmed when you have several people that you know that have passed away from something. And so we've looked into collectively, Jacob and I, into several different scenarios of these because we have heard of people that were close in the community, and they just weren't statistically significant compared to the population in the rest of the state. So just to point that out, it's personal because it's a small community.
Yeah. I brought up the unintentional injury. And this is for 2013-2015 to... I selected these years because it was the same years that CDPHE had for our top five leading causes of death. I broke it down by age because we were interested in looking at, okay, where, you know, when we're looking at motor vehicle, is it, you know, if it's in a younger population, is it related to child safety seats? Or if it's in kind of that, 18 or older, is it seatbelt use? Unfortunately, all of the age data is suppressed. So what that means is there were three or less cases reported within that age group. And this is all from the vital statistics. So the Colorado Health Indicator database uses our vital statistics records to populate this database. But then when you look at non-transport unintentional injuries, you can see where you can kind of... You see some differences in separation of, you know, you can see in the 25 to 44 that there were significant rates of individuals dying, whether that's from drownings or poisonings.
So those are fatalities on the right-hand side,
yes.
Or just injuries?
So these are, so when we, when it's...
Oh, there are fatalities,
yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. I'm sorry.
Due to injury, right?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you really look at type, so when you break down poisoning, drowning, et cetera, and by age, you can't really find out what exactly is going on. And even sometimes we break down by type, it can be suppressed. So this includes poisonings, drownings.
Overdoses too?
Yes. It would include a lot of it's a big category.
Overdose and food poisoning.
Yeah. So you just wanted to show a comparison for 2013-15 for us versus the state here. And then lastly, I wanted to also hit on suicide, since that is one of our top five main causes of death. And within 2013 to 2015, you can see that we had a higher rate than the state of Colorado. Within from looking through this data and looking at age groups, typically it's higher in males 45 through 64. So it's in an older group. But CHI does have some newer data coming out, looking at suicide rates throughout the state, as well as some in our region. So this is could be a potential category when we're talking about mental health and maybe a specific strategy on reductions of suicide rate or suicide hospitalizations. So, last slide, my next steps. The community health needs assessment is currently being finalized and written. There are the partnership is going to present to the group that has participated in this whole process of the hospitals, UC Health, MRH, MindSprings, our agency, and any other partners that were involved, just to kind of share a breakdown, and then we'll be sharing that out as well, and including this in our priorities piece for the next phase or next sections for the public health improvement plan. So end of this month, early May, convening our county-specific work groups using the data we have, any new data that if they found any, as well as the needs assessment, to really prioritize and identify 3 to 5 areas for each county, start the discussion of outcomes and strategies, and then share this information with you all for final approval to move forward with the writing of the public health improvement plan. End of May, working on finalizing the strategies. So how are we going to address this this priority? What are the outcomes? How are we going to measure a success within that strategy, as well as how we're going to evaluate it? So that includes the time frame as well. It's my intention that this group doesn't just stop meeting after the writing of the public health improvement plan, but meeting periodically, whether that's once a year for a couple of
years. See if we're actually doing it.
Yeah. Follow up on the evaluation piece, and also inviting those that are that have identified a strategy and working on it to maybe present as well, and kind of lead that group, rather than just us telling them what to do.
I think it's a reasonable, in my mind, to at least talk about it during these meetings on a quarterly basis. It doesn't need to be what the whole meeting's about, but it can be just a quick bullet point, just some discussion along those lines.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Does any of this have anything to do with the community health dashboard that the Community Health Partnership is working
on? Yes. I'm participating within that group.
Okay.
So the data that I have found that we've used for this project is also I've given to the partnership to use as sources. A lot of our partners are participating in the dashboard to identify some priorities and strategies. I fully anticipate that our strategies here will be reflected on the dashboard and included there. And a lot of their, some of their priority areas are substance use behavioral health, kind of together, looking at economic vitality and some environmental pieces as well, some more like built environment. And those are just some small pieces. Where we have one more meeting in May 15th, and we should be looking at our first strategy map then. But yes, the dashboard is a great place for this to live, as well as some of the data. So we have access to that information on a fairly regular basis, rather than having to fully rely on the state to provide that in a timely manner.
Got it. I think
good.
Yeah.
I think I asked all my questions.
That's great. Thank you all
Thank
for
you.
Your time.
Appreciate yeah. it.
Thank you. Absolutely.
You guys, and maybe this is an email later, but you know, we get together to build these agendas. And is there anything in particular that's sticking out in your mind that you can think about it that you'd like to discuss in the next meeting?
Okay.
And I'm also thinking about, you know, we're going through public health transformation. We are looking at our model for public health. I think we need to think about how we structure this model affects our ability to, create these types of plans and to deliver those services. And so just food for thought.
Yep.
Things we are thinking about. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.